Goddamn Don Adler. Little Women turned out to be a carrot dangled in front of me, because as soon as I became Evelyn Hugo, young blonde, Sunset had all sorts of movies they wanted me to do, dumb, sentimental comedy stuff. I was okay with it for two reasons. One, I had no choice but to be all right with it because I didn't hold the cards, and two, my star was rising. Fast. The first movie they gave me to star in was Father and Daughter. We shot it in 1956. Ed Baker played my widowed father, and the two of us were falling in love with people at the same time, him with his secretary, me with his apprentice. During that time, Harry was really pushing for me to go out on a few dates with Brick Thomas. Brick was a former child star and a matinee idol who, honest to God, thought he might be the Messiah. Just standing next to him, I thought I might drown in the self-adoration cascading off him. One Friday night, Brick and I met with Harry and Gwendolyn Peters a few blocks from Chasen's. Gwen put me in a dress, hose, and heels. She put my hair in an updo. Brick showed up in dungarees and a t-shirt, and Gwen put him in a nice suit. We drove Harry's brand-new crimson Cadillac Biarritz the half-mile to the front door. People were taking pictures of Brick and me before we even got out of the car. We were escorted to a circular booth where the two of us packed ourselves in tight together. I ordered a Shirley Temple. "How old are you, sweetheart?" Brick asked me. 18, I said. "So I bet you had my picture up on your wall, huh?" It took everything I had not to grab my drink and throw it right in his face. Instead, I smiled as politely as possible and said, "How do you know?" Photographers snapped shots as we sat together. We pretended not to see them, making it look as if we were laughing together, arm in arm. An hour later, we were back with Harry and Gwendolyn, changing into our normal clothes. Just before Brick and I said goodbye, he turned to me and smiled. "Gonna be a lot of rumors about you and me tomorrow," he said. "Sure are. Let me know if you want to make 'em true." I should have kept quiet. I should have just smiled nicely, but instead I said, "Don't hold your breath." Brick looked at me and laughed and then waved goodbye as if I hadn't just insulted him. "Can you believe that guy?" I said. Harry had already opened my door and was waiting for me to get into the car. "That guy makes us a lot of money," he said as I sat down. Harry got in on the other side and turned the key in the ignition, but didn't start driving. Instead, he looked at me. "I'm not saying you should be dallying around too much with these actors you don't like," he said. "But it would do you some good, if you liked one, if things progressed past a photo op or two. The studio would like it. The fans would like it." Naively, I had thought I was done pretending to like the attention of every man I came across. "Okay," I said rather petulantly, "I'll try." And while I knew it was the best thing to do for my career, I grinned through my teeth on dates with Pete Greer and Bobby Donovan. But then Harry set me up on a date with Don Adler, and I forgot why I would ever have resented the idea in the first place. Don Adler invited me out to Mocambo, without a doubt the hottest club in town, and he picked me up at my apartment. I opened the door to see him in a nice suit with a bouquet of lilies. He was just a few inches taller than me in my heels, light brown hair, hazel eyes, square jaw, the kind of smile that the moment you saw it made you smile. It was the smile his mother had been famous for, now on a handsomer face. "For you," he said, just a bit shyly. "Wow," I said, taking them from him. "They're gorgeous. Come in, come in. I'll put them in some water." I was wearing a boat-neck, sapphire-blue cocktail dress, my hair up in a chignon. I grabbed a vase from underneath the sink and turned the water on. "You didn't have to do all this," I said, as Don stood in my kitchen, waiting for me. "Well," he said, "I wanted to. I've been hounding Harry to meet you for a while, so it was the least I could do to make you feel special." I put the flowers on the counter. Shall we? Don nodded and took my hand. I saw father and daughter, he said, when we were in his convertible and headed over to the Sunset Strip.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Ari showed me an early cut. He says he thinks it's going to be a big hit. Says he thinks you're going to be a big hit.
And what did you think?
We were stopped at a red light on Highland. Don looked at me. I think you're the most gorgeous woman I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, stop, I said. I found myself laughing, blushing even.
Truly. And a real talent, too. When the movie ended, I looked right at Ari and said, "That's the girl for me."
You did not, I said.
Don put up his hand. Scout's honor.
There's absolutely no reason a man like Don Adler should have a different effect on me from the rest of the men in the world. He was no more handsome than Brick Thomas, no more earnest than Ernie Diaz, and he could offer me stardom whether I loved him or not. But these things defy reason.
I blame pheromones, ultimately.
That and the fact that, at least at first, Don Adler treated me like a person.
There are people who see a beautiful flower and rush over to pick it. They want to hold it in their hands. They want to own it. They want the flower's beauty to be theirs, to be within their possession, their control. Don wasn't like that. At least not at first. Don was happy to be near the flower, to look at the flower, to appreciate the flower simply being.
Here's the thing about marrying a guy like that, a guy like Don Adler back then. You're saying to him, this beautiful thing you've been happy to simply appreciate, well, now it's yours to own.
Don and I partied the night away at the Macambo. It was a real scene, crowds outside packed tight as sardines trying to get in, inside a celebrity playground, tables upon tables filled with famous people. High ceilings, incredible stage acts, and birds everywhere. Actual live birds in glass aviaries.
Don introduced me to a few actors from MGM and Warner Brothers. I met Bonnie Lakeland, who had just gone freelance and made it big with Money Honey. I heard more than once someone refer to Don as the Prince of Hollywood. And I found it charming when he turned to me after the third time someone said it and whispered, "They are underestimating me. I'll be king one of these days." Don and I stayed at Macambo well past midnight, dancing together until our feet hurt. Every time a song ended, we said we were going to sit down. But once a new one started, we refused to leave the floor. He drove me home, the streets quiet at the late hour, the lights dim all over town. When we got to my apartment, he walked me to my door. He didn't ask to come in. He just said, "When can I see you again?"
"Call Harry and make a date," I said.
Don put his hand on the door. "No," he said. "Really, me and you."
"And the cameras?" I said.
"If you want them there, fine," he said. "If you don't, neither do I." He smiled, a sweet, teasing smile.
I laughed.
"Okay," I said. "How about next Friday?"
Don thought about it a second.
"Can I tell you the truth about something?"
"If you must."
"I'm scheduled to go to the Trocadero with Natalie Ember next Friday night."
"Oh."
"It's the name, the Adler name. Sunset's trying to squeeze all the fame out of me that they can."
I shook my head.
"I don't think it's just the name," I told him. "I've seen Brothers in Arms. You're great. The whole audience loved you."
Don looked at me shyly and smiled.
"You really think so?"
I laughed.
He knew it was true. He just liked hearing it come out of my mouth.
"I won't give you the satisfaction," I said.
"I wish you would."
"Enough of that," I told him. "I've told you when I'm free. You do with it what you will."
He stood tall, listening to what I'd said as if I'd given him orders.
"Okay. I'll cancel Natalie, then. I'll pick you up here on Friday at 7.
I smiled and nodded.
"Good night, Don," I said.
"Good night, Evelyn," he said. I started to shut the door, and he put his hand up, stopping me. Did you have a good time tonight? He asked me. I thought about what to say, how to say it, and then I lost control of myself, giddy to feel excited by someone for the first time. One of the better nights of my life, I said. Don smiled. Me too. The next day, our picture appeared in Sub Rosa magazine with the caption, Don Adler and Evelyn Hugo make quite the pair. Father and Daughter was a huge hit, and as a show of just how excited Sunset was about my new persona, they credited me in the beginning of the movie as introducing Evelyn Hugo. It was the first and only time my name was under the marquee. On opening night, I thought of my mother. I knew that if she could have been there with me, she would have been beaming. I did it, I wanted to tell her. We're both out of there. When the movie did well, I thought Sunset would certainly greenlight Little Women, but Ari wanted Ed Baker and me in another movie as fast as possible. We didn't do sequels back then. Instead, we would essentially just make the same movie again with a different name and a slightly different conceit. So we commenced shooting on Next Door. Ed played my uncle, who had taken me in after my parents died. The two of us quickly fell into respective romantic entanglements with the widowed mother and son who lived next to us. Don was shooting a thriller on the lot at the time, and he used to come visit me every day when his set broke for lunch. I was absolutely smitten, in love and lust for the very first time. I found myself brightening up the moment I set eyes on him, always finding reasons to touch him, reasons to bring him up in conversation when he wasn't around. Harry was sick of hearing about him. "Ev, honey, I'm serious," Harry said one afternoon in his office when the two of us were sharing a drink. "I've had it up to my eyeballs with this Don Adler talk." I visited Harry about once a day back then, just to check in, see how he was doing. I always made it seem like business, but even then I knew he was the closest thing I had to a friend. Sure, I'd become friendly with a lot of the other actresses at Sunset. Ruby Riley, in particular, was a favorite of mine. She was tall and lean, with a dynamite laugh and an air of detachment to her. She never minced words, but she could charm the pants off almost anybody. Sometimes Ruby and I and some of the other girls on the lot would grab lunch and gossip about various goings-on, but to be honest, I would have thrown every single one of them in front of a moving train to get apart, and I think they would have done the same to me. Intimacy is impossible without trust, and we would have been idiots to trust one another. But Harry was different. Harry and I both wanted the same thing. We wanted Evelyn Hugo to be a household name. Also, we just liked each other. "We can talk about Don, or we can talk about when you're greenlighting Little Women," I said teasingly. Harry laughed. "It's not up to me, you know that." "Well, why is Ari dragging his feet?" "You don't want to do Little Women right now," Harry says. "It's better if you give it a few months." "I most certainly do want to do it right now." Harry shook his head and stood up, pouring himself another glass of scotch. He didn't offer me a second martini, and I knew it was because he knew I shouldn't have had the first one to begin with. "You could really be big," Harry said. "Everybody's saying so. If Next Door does as well as Father and Daughter, and you and Don keep going on the way you have been, you could be a big deal." "I know," I said. "That's what I'm banking on." "You want Little Women to come out just when people are thinking you only know how to do one thing." "What do you mean?" "You had a huge hit with Father and Daughter. People know you can be funny. They know you're adorable. They know they liked you in that picture." "Sure." "Now you're going to do it again. You're going to show them that you can recreate the magic. You're not just a one-trick pony." "All right. Maybe you do a picture with Don. After all,
They can't print pictures of the two of you dancing at Ciro's or the Trocadero fast enough.
But hear me out. You and Don do a picture. A matinee romance, maybe. Something where all the girls want to be you and all the boys want to be with you. Fine. And just when everyone is thinking they know you, that they get Evelyn Hugo, you play Joe. You knock everybody's socks off. Now the audience is going to think to themselves, I knew she was something special. But why can't I just do Little Women now, and they'll think that now? Harry shook his head. Because you have to give them time to invest in you. You have to give them time to get to know you. You're saying I should be predictable. I'm saying you should be predictable and then do something unpredictable, and they'll love you forever. I listened to him, thought about it. You're just feeding me a line, I said. Harry laughed. Look, this is Ari's plan. Like it or not, he wants you in a few more pictures before he's going to give you Little Women. But he is going to give you Little Women. All right, I said. What choice did I have, really? My contract with Sunset was for another 3 years. If I caused too much trouble, they had an option to drop me at any time. They could loan me out, force me to take projects, put me on leave without pay, you name it. They could do anything they wanted. Sunset owned me. Your job now, Harry said, is to see if you can make a real go of it with Don. It's in both of your best interests. I laughed. Oh, now you want to talk about Don. Harry smiled. I don't want to sit here and listen to you talk about how dreamy he is. That's boring. I want to know if the two of you might be ready to make it official. Don and I had been seen around town, our photos taken at every hot spot in Hollywood, dinner at Dantana's, lunch at the Vine Street Derby, tennis at the Beverly Hills Tennis Club, and we knew what we were doing, parading around in public. I needed Don's name mentioned in the same sentences as mine, and Don needed to look like he was a part of the new Hollywood. Photos of the two of us double-dating with other stars went a long way toward solidifying his image as a man about town. But he and I never talked about any of that. Because we were genuinely happy to be around each other. The fact that it was helping our careers felt like a bonus. The night of the premiere of his movie Big Trouble, Don picked me up wearing a slick dark suit and holding a Tiffany box. What's this? I asked him. I was wearing a black and purple floral Christian Dior. Open it, Don said, smiling. Inside was a giant platinum and diamond ring. It was braided on the sides with a square-cut jewel in the middle. I gasped. Are you? I knew it had been coming, if only because I knew Don wanted to sleep with me so bad it was nearly killing him. I'd been resisting him despite his very overt advances, but it was getting harder to do. The more we kissed in dark places, the more we found ourselves alone in the backs of limousines, the harder it was for me to push him away. I'd never had that feeling before, physical yearning. I'd never felt what it is to ache to be touched until Don. I would find myself next to him, desperate to feel his hands on my bare skin. And I loved the idea of making love to someone. I'd had sex before, but it had never meant anything to me. I wanted to make love to Don. I loved him. And I wanted us to do it right. And here it was, a marriage proposal. I put my hand out to touch the ring, to make sure it was all real. Don shut the box before I could. I'm not asking you to marry me, he said. What? I felt foolish. I'd allowed myself to dream too big. Here I was, Evelyn Herrera, parading around as if my name was Evelyn Hugo and I could marry a movie star. At least not yet. I tried to hide my disappointment. Have it your way, then, I said, turning away from him to grab my clutch. Don't be sour, Don said. Who's sour, I said. We walked out of my apartment and I shut the door behind me. I'm going to ask you tonight. His voice was pleading, nearly apologetic, at the premiere, in front of everyone. I softened. I just wanted to make sure. I wanted to know. Don grabbed my hand and got down on one knee. He didn't open the ring box again. He just looked at me sincerely. Will you say yes? We should go, I said. You can't be late to your own movie. Will you say yes? That's all I need to know. I looked right at him and said, Yes, you dumb fool, I'm mad for you. He grabbed me and kissed me. It hurt a little. His teeth hit my lower lip. I was going to get married. To someone I loved this time. To someone who made me feel the way I was pretending to feel in the movies. What could be any further from that tiny, sad apartment in Hell's Kitchen than this? An hour later, on the red carpet, in a sea of photographers and publicists, Don Adler got down on one knee. Evelyn Hugo, will you marry me? I cried and nodded. He stood up and put the ring on my finger, and then he picked me up and spun me in the air. As Don put me back down, I saw Harry Cameron by the theater door, clapping for us. He gave me a wink.
Sub Rosa, March 4th, 1957. Don and Ev for Ev. You heard it here first, folks. Hollywood's newest it couple, Don Adler and Evelyn Hugo, are tying the knot. The most eligible of eligible bachelors has chosen none other than the sparkling blonde starlet to be his bride. The two have been seen canoodling and cavorting all over, and now they've decided to make it official. Rumor has it that Mary and Roger Adler, Don's oh-so-proud parents, couldn't be happier to have Evelyn joining the family. You can bet your bottom dollar that the nuptials will be the event of the season. With a Hollywood family this glamorous and a bride this beautiful, the whole town will be talking.
We had a beautiful wedding. 300 guests, hosted by Mary and Roger Adler. Ruby was my maid of honor. I wore a jewel-necked taffeta gown, covered with rose point lace, with sleeves down to my wrists, and a full lace skirt. It was designed by Vivian Worley, the head costumer for Sunset. Gwendolyn did my hair, pulled back into a simple but flawless bun, to which my tulle veil was attached. There wasn't much of the wedding that was planned by us. It was controlled almost entirely by Mary and Roger, and the rest by Sunset. Don was expected to play the game exactly the way his parents wanted it played. Even then I could tell he was eager to get out of their shadow, to eclipse their stardom with his own. Don had been raised to believe that fame was the only power worth pursuing. And what I loved about him was that he was ready to become the most powerful person in any room by becoming the most adored. And while our wedding night might have been at the whim of others, our love and our commitment to each other felt sacred. When Don and I looked into each other's eyes and held hands as we said I do at the Beverly Hills Hotel, it felt like it was just the two of us up there, despite being surrounded by half of Hollywood. Toward the end of the night, after the wedding bells and our announcement as a married couple, Harry pulled me aside. He asked me how I was doing. I'm the most famous bride in the world right now, I said. I'm great. Harry laughed. You'll be happy, he asked, with Don. He's going to take good care of you. I have no doubt about it. I believed in my heart that I'd found someone who understood me, or at least understood the me I was trying to be. At the age of 19, I thought Don was my happy ending. Harry put his arm around me and said, I'm happy for you, kid. I grabbed his hand before he could pull it away. I'd had two glasses of champagne and I was feeling fresh.
"How come you never tried anything?" I asked him. "We've known each other a few years now, not even a kiss on the cheek."
"I'll kiss you on the cheek if you want," Harry said, smiling.
"Not what I mean, and you know it."
"Did you want something to happen?" he asked me.
I wasn't attracted to Harry Cameron, despite the fact that he was a categorically attractive man.
"No," I said, "I don't think I did."
"But you wanted me to want something to happen."
I smiled. "And what if I did? Is that so wrong? I'm an actress, Harry. Don't you forget that."
Harry laughed. "You have actress written all over your face. I remember it every single day."
"Then why, Harry? What's the truth?"
Harry took a sip of his scotch and took his arm off me. "It's hard to explain."
"Try.
You're young."
I waved him off.
"Most men don't seem to have any problem with a little thing like that. My own husband is 7 years older than me."
I looked over to see Don swaying with his mother on the dance floor. Mary was still gorgeous in her 50s. She'd come to fame during the silent film era and did a few talkies before retiring. She was tall and intimidating, with a face that was striking more than anything.
Harry took another swig of his scotch and put the glass down. He looked thoughtful.
"It's a long and complicated story, but suffice it to say, you've just never been my type."
The way he said it, I knew he was trying to tell me something. Harry wasn't interested in girls like me. Harry wasn't interested in girls at all.
"You're my best friend in the world, Harry," I said. "Do you know that?"
He smiled. I got the impression he did so because he was charmed and because he was relieved. He'd revealed himself, however vaguely, and I was meeting him with acceptance, however indirectly.
"Am I really?" he asked.
I nodded. "Well then, you'll be mine." I raised my glass to him. "Best friends tell each other everything," I said. He smiled, raising his own glass.
"I don't buy that," he teased. "Not for 1 minute."
Don came over and interrupted us.
"Would you mind terribly, Cameron, if I danced with my bride?"
Harry put his hands up as if in surrender.
"She's all yours."
"That she is." I took Don's hand, and he twirled me around to the dance floor. He looked right into my eyes. He really looked at me, really saw me.
"Do you love me, Evelyn Hugo?" he asked.
"More than anything in the world."
"Do you love me, Don Adler?"
"I love your eyes and your tits and your talent. I love the fact that you've got absolutely no ass on you. I love everything about you, so to say yes would be an understatement."
I laughed and kissed him. We were surrounded by people, packed onto the dance floor. His father, Roger, was smoking a cigar with Ari Sullivan in the corner. I felt a million miles away from my old life, the old me, that girl who needed Ernie Diaz for anything at all. Don pulled me close and put his mouth to my ear, whispering, "Me and you, we will rule this town." We were married for 2 months before he started hitting me. 6 weeks into our marriage, Don and I shot a weepy on location in Puerto Vallarta. Called One More Day, it was about a rich girl, Diane, who spends the summer with her parents at their second home, and the local boy, Frank, who falls in love with her. Naturally, they can't be together because her parents don't approve. The first weeks of my marriage to Don had been nearly blissful. We bought a house in Beverly Hills and had it decorated in marble and linen. We had pool parties nearly every weekend, drinking champagne and cocktails all afternoon and into the night. Don made love like a king, truly, with the confidence and power of someone in charge of a fleet of men. I melted underneath him. In the right moment for him, I'd have done anything he wanted. He had flipped a switch in me, a switch that changed me from a woman who saw making love as a tool into a woman who knew that making love was a need. I needed him. I needed to be seen. I came alive under his gaze. Being married to Don had shown me another side of myself, a side I was just getting to know, a side I liked. When we got to Puerto Vallarta, we spent a few days in town before shooting. We took our rented boat out into the water. We dived into the ocean. We made love in the sand. But as we started shooting and the daily stresses of Hollywood started fracturing our newlywed cocoon, I could tell the tide was turning. Don's last movie, The Gun at Point Doom, wasn't doing well at the box office. It was his first time in a Western, his first crack at playing an action hero. Photo Moment had just published a review saying, "Don Adler is no John Wayne." Hollywood Digest wrote, "Adler looks like a fool holding a gun." I could tell it was bothering him, making him doubt himself. Establishing himself as a masculine action hero was a vital part of his plan. His father had mostly played the straight man in madcap comedies, a clown. Don was out to prove he was a cowboy. It did not help that I had just won an Audience Appreciation Award for Best Rising Star. On the day we shot the final goodbye, where Diane and Frank kiss one last time on the beach, Don and I woke up in our rented bungalow, and he told me to make him breakfast. Mind you, he did not ask me to make him breakfast. He barked the order. Regardless, I ignored his tone and called down to the maid. She was a Mexican woman named Maria. When we had first arrived, I was unsure if I should speak Spanish to the local people, and then without ever making a formal decision about it, I found myself speaking slow, over-enunciated English to everyone. "Maria, will you please make Mr. Adler some breakfast?" I said into the phone. And then I turned to Don and said, "What would you like, some coffee and eggs?" Our maid back in Los Angeles, Paula, made his breakfast every morning. She knew just how he liked it. I realized in that moment that I'd never paid attention. Frustrated, Don grabbed the pillow from under his head and smashed it over his face, screaming into it. "What has gotten into you?" I said. "If you're not going to be the kind of wife who is going to make me breakfast, you can at least know how I like it." He escaped to the bathroom. I was bothered, but not entirely surprised. I had quickly learned that Don was only kind when he was happy, and he was only happy when he was winning. I had met him on a winning streak, married him as he was ascending. I was quickly learning that sweet Don was not the only Don. Later, in our rented Corvette, Don backed out of the driveway and started heading the 10 blocks toward set. "Are you ready for today?" I asked him. I was trying to be uplifting. Don stopped in the middle of the road. He turned to me. "I've been a professional actor for longer than you've been alive." This was true, albeit on a technicality. He was in one of Mary's silent movies as a baby. He didn't act in a movie again until he was 21. There were a few cars behind us now. We were holding up traffic. "Don," I said, trying to encourage him to move forward. He wasn't listening. The white truck behind us started pulling around, trying to get past us. "Do you know what Alan Thomas said to me yesterday?" Don said. Alan Thomas was his new agent. Alan had been encouraging Don to leave Sunset Studios to go freelance. A lot of actors were navigating their careers on their own. It was leading to big paychecks for big stars, and Don was getting antsy. He kept talking about making more for one picture than his parents had made their whole careers. Be wary of men with something to prove. "People around town are asking why you're still going by Evelyn Hugo." "I changed my name legally." "What do you mean?" "On the marquee. It should say Don and Evelyn Adler. That's what people are saying."
"Who is saying that?"
"People."
"What people?"
"They think you wear the pants." My head fell into my hands. Don, you're being silly. Another car came up around us, and I watched as they recognized Don and me. We were seconds away from a full page in Sub Rosa magazine about how Hollywood's favorite couple were at each other's throat. They'd probably say something like, "The Adlers gone Madlers." I suspected Don saw the headlines writing themselves at the same time I did, because he started the car and drove us to set. When we pulled onto the lot, I said, "I can't believe we're almost 45 minutes late." And Don said, "Yeah, well, we're Adlers. We can be." I found it absolutely repugnant. I waited until the two of us were in his trailer, and I said, "When you talk like that, you sound like a horse's ass. You shouldn't say things like that where people can hear you." He was taking off his jacket. Wardrobe was due in any moment. I should have just left and gone to my own trailer. I should have let him be. "I think you have gotten the wrong impression here, Evelyn," Don said. "And how is that?" He came right up into my face. "We are not equals, love. And I'm sorry if I've been so kind that you've forgotten that." I was speechless. "I think this should be the last movie you do," he said. "I think it's time for us to have children." His career wasn't turning out the way he wanted. And if he wasn't going to be the most famous person in his family, he surely wasn't going to allow that person to be me. I looked right at him and said, "Absolutely, positively not." And he smacked me across the face. Sharp, fast, strong. It was over before I even knew what happened, the skin on my face stinging from the blow I could barely believe had come my way. If you've never been smacked across the face, let me tell you something. It is humiliating. Mostly because your eyes start to tear up, whether you mean to be crying or not. The shock of it and the sheer force of it stimulate your tear ducts. There is no way to take a smack across the face and look stoic. All you can do is remain still and stare straight ahead, allowing your face to turn red and your eyes to bloom. So that's what I did. The way I'd done it when my father hit me. I put my hand to my jaw, and I could feel the skin heating up under my hand. The assistant director knocked on the door. "Mr. Adler, is Miss Hugo with you?" Don was unable to speak. "One minute, Bobby," I said. I was impressed by how unstrained my voice was, how confident it seemed. It sounded like the voice of a woman who had never been hit a day in her life. There were no mirrors I could get to easily. Don had his back to them, blocking them. I pushed my jaw forward. "Is it red?" I said. Don could barely look at me, but he glanced and then nodded his head. He was boyish and ashamed, as if I were asking him if he'd been the one to break the neighbor's window. "Go out there and tell Bobby I'm having lady troubles. He'll be too embarrassed to ask anything else. Then tell your wardrobe person to meet you in my dressing room. Have Bobby tell mine to meet me in here in a half hour." "Okay," he said, and then grabbed his jacket and slipped out. The minute he was out the door, I locked myself inside and slumped down against the wall, the tears coming fast the moment no one could see them. I had made my way 3,000 miles from where I was born. I had found a way to be in the right place at the right time. I'd changed my name, changed my hair, changed my teeth and my body. I'd learned how to act. I'd made the right friends. I'd married into a famous family. Most of America knew my name. And yet. I got up off the floor and wiped my eyes. I gathered myself. I sat down at the vanity, three mirrors in front of me lined with light bulbs. How silly is it that I thought that if I ever found myself in a movie star's dressing room, that meant I'd have no troubles? A few moments later, Gwendolyn knocked on the door to do my hair. "One second," I yelled out. "Evelyn, we have to move quickly. You guys are already behind schedule. Just one second." I looked at myself in the mirror and realized I couldn't force the redness to go away. The question was whether I trusted Gwen, and I decided I did. I had to. I stood up and opened the door.
"Oh, sweetheart," she said, "you look a fright."
"I know." She looked more closely at me and realized what she was seeing.
"Did you fall?"
"Yes," I said, "I did. I fell right over, onto the counter. Jaw caught the worst of it." We both knew I was lying. And to this day, I'm not sure whether Gwen asked me if I fell in order to spare me the need to lie, or to encourage me to keep quiet. I wasn't the only woman being hit back then. A lot of women were negotiating the very same things I was at that moment. There was a social code for these things, the first rule being to shut up about it. An hour later, I was being escorted to set. We were to film a scene just outside a mansion on the beach. Don was sitting in his chair, the four wooden legs digging into the sand behind the director. He ran up to me. "How are you feeling, sweetheart?" His voice was so chipper, so consoling, that for a moment I thought he had forgotten what happened. "I'm fine. Let's get on with it." We took our places. The sound guy mic'd us. The grips made sure we were lit properly. I put everything out of my head.
"Hold on, hold on," the director yelled. "Ronnie, what's going on with the boom?"
Distracted by a conversation, he walked away from the camera. Don covered his mic and then put his hand on my chest and covered mine.
"Evelyn, I'm so sorry," he whispered into my ear.
I pulled back and looked at him, stunned. No one had ever apologized for hitting me before. "I never should have laid a hand on you," he said. His eyes were filling with tears. "I'm ashamed of myself for doing anything at all to hurt you." He looked so pained. "I will do anything for your forgiveness." Maybe the life I thought I had wasn't so far away after all.
"Can you forgive me?" he asked.
Maybe this was all a mistake. Maybe it didn't mean anything had to change.
"Of course I can," I said.
The director ran back to the camera, and Don leaned back, taking his hands off our mics.
"And action!"
Don and I were both nominated for Academy Awards for One More Day, and I think the general consensus was that it didn't matter how talented we were. People just loved seeing us together. To this day, I have no idea if either of us is actually any good in it. It is the only movie I've ever shot that I cannot bring myself to watch. A man hits you once and apologizes, and you think it will never happen again. But then you tell him you're not sure you ever want a family, and he hits you once more. You tell yourself it's understandable what he did. You were sort of rude the way you said it. You do want a family someday. You truly do. You're just not sure how you're going to manage it with your movies. But you should have been more clear. The next morning, he apologizes and brings you flowers. He gets down on his knees. The third time, it's a disagreement about whether to go out to Romanov's or stay in, which you realize when he pushes you into the wall behind you is actually about the image of your marriage to the public. The fourth time, it's after you both lose at the Oscars. You are in a silk emerald green one-shoulder dress. He's in a tux with tails. He has too much to drink at the after parties, trying to nurse his wounds. You're in the front seat of the car in your driveway, about to go inside. He's upset that he lost. You tell him it's okay. He tells you that you don't understand. You remind him that you lost too. He says, "Yeah, but your parents are trash from Long Island. No one expects anything from you." You know you shouldn't, but you say, "I'm from Hell's Kitchen, you asshole." He opens the parked car's door and pushes you out. When he comes crawling to you in tears the next morning, you don't actually believe him anymore. But now this is just what you do. the same way you fix the hole in your dress with a safety pin or tape up the crack in a window. That's the part I was stuck in. The part where you accept the apology because it's easier than addressing the root of the problem. When Harry Cameron came to my dressing room and told me the good news, Little Women was getting the green light. It's you as Jo, Ruby Riley as Meg, Joy Nathan as Amy, and Celia St. James is playing Beth. Celia St. James? From Olympian Studios? Harry nodded. What's with the frown? I thought you'd be thrilled. Oh, I said, turning further toward him. I am. I absolutely am. You don't like Celia St. James? I smiled at him. That teenage bitch is gonna act me under the table. Harry threw his head back and laughed. Celia St. James had made headlines earlier in the year. At the age of 19, she played a young widowed mother in a war period piece. Everyone said she was sure to be nominated next year. Exactly the sort of person the studio would want playing Beth, and exactly the sort of person Ruby and I would hate. You're 21 years old. You're married to the biggest movie star there is right now, and you were just nominated for an Academy Award, Evelyn. Harry had a point, but so did I. Celia was going to be a problem. It's okay. I'm ready. I'm going to give the best goddamn performance of my life, and when people watch the movie, they are going to say, Beth who? Oh, the middle sister who dies? What about her? I have absolutely no doubt, Harry said, putting his arm around me. You're fabulous, Evelyn. The whole world knows it. I smiled. You really think so? This is something that everyone should know about stars. We like to be told we are adored, and we want you to repeat yourself. Later in my life, people would always come up to me and say, I'm sure you don't want to hear me blabbering on about how great you are, and I always say, as if I'm joking, oh, one more time won't hurt. But the truth is, praise is just like an addiction. The more you get it, the more of it you need just to stay even. Yes, he said. I really think so. I stood up from my chair to give Harry a hug, but as I did, the lighting highlighted my upper cheekbone, the rounded spot just below my eye. I watched as Harry's gaze ran across my face. He could see the light bruise I was hiding, could see the purple and blue under the surface of my skin, bleeding through the pancake makeup. Evelyn, he said. He put his thumb up to my face as if he needed to feel it, to know it was real. Harry, don't. I'll kill him. No, you won't. We're best friends, Evelyn, me and you. I know, I said. I know that. You said best friends tell each other everything. And you knew it was bullshit when I said it. I stared at him as he stared at me. Let me help, he said. What can I do? You can make sure I look better than Celia, better than all of them, in the dailies. That's not what I mean. But it's all you can do. Evelyn, I kept my upper lip stiff. There's no move here, Harry. He understood what I meant. I couldn't leave Don Adler. I could talk to Ari. I love him, I said, turning away and clipping my earrings on. It was the truth. Don and I had problems, but so did a lot of people. And he was the only man who had ever ignited something in me. Sometimes I hated myself for wanting him, for finding myself brightening up when his attention was on me, for still needing his approval. But I did. I loved him, and I wanted him in my bed, and I wanted to stay in the spotlight. End of discussion. A moment later, there was another knock on my door. It was Ruby Riley. She was shooting a drama where she played a young nun. She was standing in front of the two of us in a black tunic and a white cowl. Her hood was in her hand. Did you hear? Ruby said to me. Well, of course you heard. Harry's here. Harry laughed. You both start rehearsals in 3 weeks. Ruby hit Harry on the arm playfully. No, not that part. Did you hear Celia St. James is playing Beth?
That tart's gonna show us all up.
See, Harry, I said, Celia St. James is going to ruin everything. The morning we started rehearsals for Little Women, Don woke me up with breakfast in bed, half a grapefruit and a lit cigarette. I found this highly romantic because it was exactly what I wanted. Good luck today, sweetheart, he said as he got dressed and headed out the door. I know you'll show Celia St. James what it really means to be an actress. I smiled and wished him a good day. I ate the grapefruit and left the tray in bed as I got into the shower. When I got out, our maid Paula was in the bedroom cleaning up after me. She was picking the butt of my cigarette off the duvet. I'd left it on the tray, but it must have fallen. I didn't keep a neat house. My clothes from last night were on the floor. My slippers were on top of the dresser. My towel was in the sink. Paula had her work cut out for her, and she didn't find me particularly charming. That much was clear. Can you do that later? I said to her. I'm terribly sorry, but I'm in a rush to get to set. She smiled politely and left. I wasn't in a rush, really. I just wanted to get dressed, and I wasn't going to do that in front of Paula. I didn't want her to see that there was a bruise, dark purple and yellowing on my ribs. Don had pushed me down the stairs 9 days before. Even as I say it, all these years later, I feel the need to defend him, to say that it wasn't as bad as it sounds, that we were toward the bottom of the stairs, and he gave me a shove that bumped me down about 4 steps and onto the floor. Unfortunately, the table by the door where we kept the keys and the mail is what caught my fall. I landed on it on my left side, the handle on the top drawer getting me right in the rib cage. When I said that I thought I might have broken a rib, Don said, "Oh, no, honey, are you all right?" As if he wasn't the one who pushed me. Like an idiot, I said, "I think I'm fine." The bruise wasn't going away quickly. Paula burst back in through the door a moment later. "Sorry, Mrs. Adler, I forgot the—" I panicked. "For heaven's sake, Paula, I asked you to leave." She turned around and walked out. And what pissed me off more than anything was that if she was going to sell a story, why wasn't it that one? Why didn't she tell the world that Don Adler was beating his wife? Why instead did she come after me? 2 hours later, I was on the set of Little Women. The soundstage had been turned into a New England cabin, complete with snow on the windows. Ruby and I were united in our fight against Celia St. James stealing the movie from us, despite the fact that anyone who plays Beth leaves the audience reaching for the hankies. You can't tell an actress that a rising tide lifts all boats. It doesn't work that way for us. But on the first day of rehearsals, as Ruby and I hung out by craft services and drank coffee, it became clear that Celia St. James had absolutely no idea how much we all hated her. "Oh, God," she said, coming up to Ruby and me, "I'm so scared." She was wearing gray trousers and a pale pink short-sleeved sweater. She had a childlike girl-next-door kind of face. Big, round, pale blue eyes, long lashes, Cupid's bow lips, long strawberry red hair. She was simplicity perfected. I was the sort of beautiful that women knew they could never truly emulate. Men knew they would never even get close to a woman like me. Ruby was the elegant, aloof sort of beauty. Ruby was cool. Ruby was chic. But Celia was the sort of beautiful that felt as if you could hold it in your hands. Like if you played your cards right, you might just get to marry a girl like Celia St. James. Ruby and I both were aware of what kind of power that is. Accessibility. Celia toasted a piece of bread at the craft services table and slathered it with peanut butter and then bit into it. "What on earth are you scared of?" Ruby said. "I have no idea what I'm doing," Celia said. "Celia, you can't really expect us to fall for this aw shucks routine," I said. She looked at me, and the way she did it made me feel as if no one had ever really looked at me before. Not even Don. "That hurts my feelings," she said. I felt a little bit bad, but I certainly wasn't going to let on. "I didn't mean anything by it," I said. "Yes, you absolutely did," Celia said. "I think you're a bit of a cynic." Ruby, that fair-weather friend, pretended to hear the AD calling for her and took off. "I just have a hard time believing a woman the entire town is saying will be nominated next year is doubting her ability to play Beth March. It's the chewiest, most likable role in the whole thing." "If it's such a sure thing, then why didn't you take it?" she asked me. "I'm too old, Celia, but thank you for that." Celia smiled, and I realized I'd played right into her hands. That's when I started to take a liking to Celia St. James.
"Let's pick up here tomorrow," Evelyn says. The sun set long ago. As I look around, I notice the remains of breakfast, lunch, and dinner scattered across the room. "Okay," I say. "By the way," she adds as I start to pack up, "my publicist got an email today from your editor, inquiring about a photo shoot for the June cover." "Oh," I say. "Frankie has checked in on me a few times now. I know I need to call her back, update her on this situation. I'm just not sure of my next move." "I take it you haven't told them the plan," Evelyn says. I place my computer in my bag. "Not yet." I hate the slight tint of sheepishness that comes out when I say it. "That's fine," Evelyn says. "I'm not judging you, if that's what you're worried about. God knows I'm no defender of the truth." I laugh. "You'll do what you need to do," she says. "I will," I say. I just don't know what exactly that is yet. When I get home, the package from my mother is sitting just inside my building's door. I pick it up, only to realize that it's incredibly heavy. I end up pushing it across the tile floor with my foot. I pull it, one step at a time, up the stairs, and then I drag it into my apartment. When I open the box, it's filled with some of my father's photo albums. The front of each is embossed with James Grant in the bottom right-hand corner. Nothing can stop me from sitting down, right on the floor where I am, and looking through the photos one by one. On-set still photos of directors, famous actors, board extras, ADs, you name it, they are all in here. My dad loved his job. He loved taking pictures of people who weren't paying attention to him. I remember once, about a year before he died, he took a 2-month job in Vancouver. My mom and I went to visit him twice while he was up there, but it was so much colder than L.A., and he was gone for what felt like so long. I asked him why. Why couldn't he just work at home? Why did he have to take this job? He told me he wanted to do work that invigorated him. He said, "You have to do that too, Monique, when you're older. You have to find a job that makes your heart feel big instead of one that makes it feel small, okay? You promise me that?" He put out his hand, and I shook it, like we were making a business deal. I was 6. By the time I was 8, we'd lost him. I always kept what he said in my heart. I spent my teenage years with a burning pressure to find a passion, one that would expand my soul in some way. It was no small task. In high school, long after we'd said goodbye to my father, I tried theater, an orchestra. I tried joining the chorus. I tried soccer and debate. In a moment of what felt like epiphany, I tried photography, hoping that the thing that expanded my father's heart might expand my own. But it wasn't until I was assigned to write a profile piece on one of my classmates in my composition class freshman year at USC that I felt anything close to a swelling in my chest. I liked writing about real people. I liked finding evocative ways of interpreting the real world. I liked the idea of connecting people by sharing their stories. Following that part of my heart led me to J School at NYU, which led to my internship at WNYC. I followed that passion to a life of freelancing for embarrassing blogs, living check to check and hand to mouth, and then eventually to the Discourse, where I met David when he was working on the site's redesign, and then to Vivant, and now to Evelyn. One small thing my dad said to me on a cold day in Vancouver has essentially been the basis of my entire life's trajectory. For a brief moment, I wonder if I would have listened to him if he hadn't died. Would I have clung to his every word so tightly if his advice had felt unlimited? At the end of the last photo album, I come across candids that don't appear to be from a movie set. They were taken at a barbecue. I recognize my mom in the background of some of them, and then at the very end is one of me with my parents. I can't be more than 4 years old. I'm eating a piece of cake with my hand, looking directly into the camera, as my mother holds me and my father has his arm around us. Most people still called me by my first name, Elizabeth, back then. Elizabeth Monique Grant. My mom assured me I'd grow up to be a Liz or a Lizzie, but my father had always loved the name Monique and couldn't help but call me by it. I would often remind him that my name was Elizabeth. Then he would tell me that my name was whatever I wanted it to be. When he passed away, it became clear to both my mother and me that I should be Monique. It eased our pain ever so slightly to honor every last thing about him. So my pet name became my real name, and my mother often reminds me that my name was a gift from my father. Looking at this picture, I am struck by how beautiful my parents were together, James and Angela. I know what it cost them to build a life, to have me. A white woman and a black man in the early 80s, neither of their families being particularly thrilled with the arrangement. We moved around a lot before my father died, trying to find a neighborhood where my parents felt at ease at home. My mother didn't feel welcome in Baldwin Hills. My father didn't feel comfortable in Brentwood. I was in school before I met another person who looked like me. Her name was Yael. Her father was Dominican, and her mother was from Israel. She liked to play soccer. I liked to play dress-up. We could rarely agree on anything. But I liked that when someone asked her if she was Jewish, she said, "I'm half Jewish." No one else I knew was half something. For so long, I felt like two halves. And then my father died, and I felt like I was one half my mother and one half lost, a half that I feel so torn from, so incomplete without. But looking at this picture now, the three of us together in 1986, me in overalls, my father in a polo, my mother in a denim jacket, we look like we belong together. I don't look like I'm half of one thing and half of another, but rather one whole thing. Theirs. Loved. I miss my dad. I miss him all the time. But it's moments like this when I'm on the precipice of finally doing work that might just expand my heart that I wish I could at least send him a letter telling him what I'm doing. And I wish he could send me one back. I already know what he would write. Something like, "I'm proud of you, I love you." But still, I'd like to get one anyway. "All right," I say. My spot at Evelyn's desk has become my second home. I've come to rely on Grace's morning coffee. It has replaced my usual Starbucks habit. "Let's pick up where we left off yesterday. You're about to start Little Women. Go." Evelyn laughs.
"You've become an old hand at this," she says.
"I learn quickly."
A week into rehearsals, Don and I were lying in bed. He was asking how it was going, and I admitted that Celia was just as good as I'd thought she'd be.
Well, the people of Montgomery County is going to be number one again this week. I'm at the top of my game again, and my contract is up at the end of this year. Ari Sullivan is willing to do whatever I want to make me happy. So just say the word, baby, and poof, she's out of there. No, I said to him, putting my hand on his chest and my head on his shoulder. It's okay. I'm the lead. She's supporting. I'm not going to worry too much. And anyway, there's something I like about her. There's something I like about you, he said, pulling me on top of him. And for a moment, all my worries completely disappeared. The next day when we broke for lunch, Joy and Ruby went off to get turkey salads. Celia caught my eye. There's no chance you'd want to cut out and grab a milkshake, is there? She asked. The nutritionist at Sunset would not have liked me getting a milkshake, but what he didn't know wouldn't kill him. 10 minutes later, we were in Celia's baby pink 1956 Chevy, making our way to Hollywood Boulevard. Celia was a terrible driver. I gripped the door handle as if it was capable of saving my life. Celia stopped at the light at Sunset Boulevard and Cahuenga. I'm thinking Schwab's, she said with a grin. Schwab's was the place everybody hung around during the day back then, and everybody knew that Sidney Skolsky from Photoplay worked out of Schwab's almost every day. Celia wanted to be seen there. She wanted to be seen there with me. What kind of game are you playing? I asked. I'm not playing any game, she said, falsely insulted that I'd suggest such a thing. Oh, Celia, I said, dismissing her with a wave of my hand. I've been at this a few more years than you. You're the one who just fell off the turnip truck. Don't confuse us. The light turned green and Celia gunned it. I'm from Georgia, she said, just outside of Savannah. So? I'm just saying I didn't fall off a turnip truck. I was scouted by a guy from Paramount back home. I found it somewhat intimidating, maybe even threatening, that someone had flown out to woo her. I had made my way to town through my own blood, sweat, and tears, and Celia had Hollywood running to her before she was even somebody. That may be so, I said, but I still know what game you're running, honey. Nobody goes to Schwab's for the milkshakes. Listen, she said, the tone of her voice changing slightly, becoming more sincere. I could use a story or two. If I'm going to star in my own movie soon, I need some name recognition. And this milkshake business is all just a ruse to be seen with me. I found it insulting, both being used and being underestimated. Celia shook her head. No, not at all. I wanted to go get a milkshake with you, and then when we pulled out of the lot, I thought, we should go to Schwab's. Celia stopped abruptly at the light at Sunset and Highland. I realized at that point that was just how she drove, a lead foot on both the gas and the brake. Take a right, I said. What? Take a right. Why? Celia, take the goddamn right before I open this car door and throw myself out of it. She looked at me like I was nuts, which was fair. I had just threatened to kill myself if she didn't put on her blinker. She turned right on Highland. Take a left at the light, I said. She didn't ask questions, she just put on her blinker, and then she spun onto Hollywood Boulevard. I instructed her to park the car on a side road. We walked to C.C. Brown's. They have better ice cream, I said, as we walked in. I was putting her in her place. I wasn't going to be photographed with her, unless I wanted to be, unless it was my idea. I certainly wasn't going to be pushed around by somebody less famous than I was. Celia nodded, feeling the sting. The two of us sat down, and the guy behind the counter came up to us, momentarily speechless. He said, do you want menus? I shook my head. I know what I want, Celia. She looked at him. Chocolate malt, please. I watched the way his eyes fixed on her, the way she bent forward slightly with her arms together, emphasizing her chest. She seemed unaware of what she was doing, and that mesmerized him even more. And I'll have a strawberry milkshake, I said.
When he looked at me, I saw his eyes open wider, as if he wanted to see as much of me as he could at one time. "Are you Evelyn Hugo?" "No," I said, and then I smiled and looked him right in the eye. It was ironic and teasing, with the same tone and inflection I'd used countless times when I was recognized around town. He scattered away. "Cheer up, Buttercup," I said as I looked at Celia. She was staring down at the glossy counter. "You're getting a better milkshake out of the deal." "I upset you," she said, "with the Schwab's thing. I'm sorry." "Celia, if you're going to be as big as you clearly want to be, you need to learn two things."
"And what are they?"
"First, you have to push people's boundaries and not feel bad about it. No one is going to give you anything if you don't ask for it. You tried. You were told no. Get over it."
"And the second thing?"
"When you use people, be good at it."
"I wasn't trying to use you."
"Yes, Celia, you were, and I'm fine with that. I wouldn't have a moment's hesitation in using you, and I wouldn't expect you to have a second thought about using me. Do you know the difference between the two of us?"
"There are a lot of differences between the two of us."
"Do you know the one in particular I'm talking about?" I said.
"What is it?"
"That I know I use people. I'm fine with the idea of using people, and all of that energy that you spend trying to convince yourself that you're not using people, I spend getting better at it."
"And you're proud of that?"
"I'm proud of where it's gotten me."
"Are you using me now?"
"If I was, you'd never know."
"That's why I'm asking."
The guy behind the counter came back with our milkshakes. He appeared to have to give himself a pep talk just to give them to us.
"No," I said to Celia once he was gone.
"No what?"
"No, I'm not using you."
"Well, that's a relief," Celia said. It struck me as painfully naive the way she so easily, so readily believed me. I was telling the truth, but still.
"Do you know why I'm not using you?" I said.
"This should be good," Celia said as she took a sip of her shake. I laughed, surprised by both the world-weariness in her voice and the speed with which she spoke. Celia would go on to win more Oscars than anybody else in our circle back then, and it was always for intense, dramatic roles. But I always thought she'd be dynamite in a comedy. She was so quick.
"The reason I'm not using you is that you have nothing to offer me. Not yet, at least."
Celia took a sip of her shake again, stung, and then I leaned forward and took a sip of mine.
"I don't think that's true," Celia said.
"I'll give you that you're more famous than me. Being married to Captain Hollywood can have that effect on a person. But other than that, we're at the same place, Evelyn. You've turned in a couple of good performances, so have I, and now we're in a movie together, which both of us took on because we want an Academy Award. And let's be honest, I have a leg up on you in that regard."
"And why is that?"
"Because I'm a better actress." I stopped sipping the thick shake through the straw and turned myself toward her.
"How do you figure that?"
Celia shrugged. "It's not something we can measure, I suppose, but it's true. I've seen One More Day. You're really good. But I'm better. And you know I'm better. That's why you and Don almost had me kicked off the project."
"No, we didn't."
"Yes, you did. Ruby told me."
I wasn't mad at Ruby for telling Celia what I'd told her. The same way you're not mad at a dog for barking at a mailman. That's just what they do.
"Oh, fine. So you're a better actress than me. And sure, maybe Don and I discussed getting you fired. So what? Big deal."
"Well, that's just my point exactly. I'm more talented than you, and you're more powerful than me."
"So?"
"So you're right. I'm not very good at using people, so I'm trying this a different way. Let's help each other out."
I sipped my milkshake again, mildly intrigued.
"How so?" I said.
"After hours, I'll help you with your scenes. I'll teach you what I know.
And I go with you to Schwab's." you help me do what you've done, become a star.
But then what? I said. We both end up famous and talented, competing for every job in town.
I suppose that is one option.
And the other?
I really like you, Evelyn.
I looked at her sideways. She laughed at me. I know that's probably not something most actresses mean in this town, but I don't want to be like most actresses. I really like you. I like watching you on screen. I like how the moment you show up in a scene, I can't look at anything else. I like the way your skin is too dark for your blonde hair, the way the two shouldn't go together and yet seem so natural on you. And to be honest, I like how calculating and awful you kind of are.
I am not awful. Celia laughed. Oh, you definitely are.
Getting me fired because you think I'll show you up? Awful.
That's just awful, Evelyn. And walking around bragging about how you use people? Just terrible.
But I really like it when you talk about it. I like how honest you are, how unashamed. So many women around here are full of crap with everything they say and do. I like that you're full of crap only when it gets you something.
This laundry list of compliments seems to have a lot of insults in it, I said.
Celia nodded, hearing me. You know what you want, and you go after it. I don't think there is anyone in this town doubting that Evelyn Hugo is going to be the biggest star in Hollywood one of these days. And that's not just because you're something to look at. It's because you decided you wanted to be huge, and now you're going to be.
I want to be friends with a woman like that.
That's what I'm saying. Real friends. None of this Ruby Riley backstabbing, talking about each other behind our backs crap. Friendship. Where each of us gets better, lives better, because we know the other.
I considered her. Do we have to do each other's hair and stuff like that?
Sunset pays people to do that, so no.
Do I have to listen to your man troubles?
Certainly not.
So what then? We choose to spend time together and try to be there for each other?
Evelyn, have you never had a friend before?
Of course I've had friends before.
A real one, a close friend, a true friend.
I have a true friend, thank you very much.
Who is it?
Harry Cameron.
Harry Cameron is your friend?
He's my best friend.
Well, fine, Celia said, putting out her hand for me to shake. I will be your second best friend, next to Harry Cameron.
I took her hand and shook it firmly.
Fine.
Tomorrow I'll take you to Schwab's, and afterward we can rehearse together.
Thank you, she said, and she smiled brightly, as if she'd gotten everything she'd ever wanted in the world. She hugged me, and when we broke away, the man behind the counter was staring at us. I asked for the check.
It's on the house, he said, which I thought was the dumbest thing, because if there is anyone that should be getting free food, it isn't rich people.
Will you tell your husband I loved the gun at Point Doom? The man said as Celia and I got up to leave.
What husband? I said as coyly as possible.
Celia laughed, and I flashed her a grin. But what I was really thinking was, I can't tell him that. He'll think I'm making fun of him, and he'll smack me.
Sub Rosa, June 22nd, 1959. Cold, cold Evelyn. Why would a beautiful couple with a gorgeous five-bedroom home not be interested in filling it up with a brood of children? You'd have to ask Don Adler and Evelyn Hugo that question. Or maybe you'd just have to ask Evelyn. Don wants a baby, and certainly we've all been waiting with bated breath to find out when the progeny of those two beautiful creatures will make his or her way into the world. We know any child they have would be sure to send us into fits of swooning. But Evelyn's saying no. Instead, all Evelyn talks about is her career, including her new movie, Little Women. More than that, Evelyn doesn't even attempt to keep a clean house or mind her husband's simple requests, and she can't be bothered to be kind to the help. Instead, she's out at Schwab's with single girls like Celia St. James. Poor Dawn's at home, yearning for a child, while Evelyn's out having the time of her life. It's all Evelyn, Evelyn, Evelyn in that house, and she's left a very unsatisfied husband.
"Is this really happening?" I said as I threw the magazine onto Harry's desk. But of course he'd already seen it. "It's not that bad." "It's not good." "No, it's not." "Why didn't anyone take care of this?" I asked. "Because Sub Rosa isn't listening to us anymore." "What do you mean?" "They don't care about the truth or access to stars. They are just printing whatever they want." "They care about money, don't they?" "Yes, but they will make way more by pontificating about the ins and outs of your marriage than we can afford to pay them." "You are Sunset Studios." "And if you haven't noticed, we aren't making nearly as much money as we used to." My shoulders slumped. I sat in one of the chairs facing Harry's desk. There was a knock. "It's Celia," she said through the door. I walked over and opened it for her. "I take it you've seen the piece," I said. Celia looked at me. "It's not that bad." "It's not good," I said. "No, it's not." "Thank you. You both are a pair of aces." Celia and I had finished shooting Little Women the week before. The two of us, along with Harry and Gwendolyn, had gone out for celebratory steaks and cocktails at Musso and Frank the day after we finished. Harry had given Celia and me the good news that Ari thought we were both shoo-ins for nominations. Every night after shooting, Celia and I would stay late in my trailer and rehearse our scenes. Celia was method. She tried to become her character. That wasn't really my speed, but she did teach me how to find moments of emotional truth in false circumstances. It was a strange time in Hollywood. There seemed to be two tracks running parallel to each other at the same time back then. There was the studio game, with studio actors and studio dynasties, and then there was the new Hollywood, making its way into the hearts of audiences. Method actors in gritty movies with anti-heroes and untidy endings. It wasn't until those evenings with Celia, the two of us sharing a pack of cigarettes and a bottle of wine for dinner, that I even started paying attention to the new stuff. But whatever influence she had on me was a good one, because Ari Sullivan thought I could win an Oscar. And that made me like Celia all the more. Our weekly outings to hot spots like Rodeo Drive weren't even feeling like a favor anymore. I did it happily, attracting attention for her simply because I enjoyed her company. So as I sat there in Harry's office, pretending to be pissed at both of them for not being very helpful, I knew I was with my two favorite people. "What does Don say about it?" Celia asked. "I'm sure he's going all around the lot trying to find me." Harry looked at me pointedly. He knew what might happen if Don read it in a bad mood. "Celia, are you shooting today?" he asked. She shook her head. "The Pride of Belgium doesn't start until next week. I just have some wardrobe fittings later, after lunch." "I'll move your wardrobe fittings. Why don't you and Evelyn go out shopping? We can call over to Photoplay, let them know you'll be on Robertson. And be seen out around town with single gal Celia St. James," I said. "That sounds like the perfect example of what I shouldn't do." My mind kept racing through the contents of that stupid article. She can't be bothered to be kind to the help. "That little rat," I said, when I figured it out. I hit my fist on the arm of the chair. "What are you talking about?" Harry said. "My damn maid." "You think your maid talked to Sub Rosa?" "I'm positive my maid talked to Sub Rosa." "All right, well, she's fired," Harry says. "I can have Betsy go over there today and let her go. She'll be gone by the time you get home." I thought about my options. The last thing I needed was America not wanting to see my movies because I wouldn't give Don a baby. I knew, of course, that most moviegoers would never say as much. They might not even realize they thought as much. But they would read something like this, and the next time one of my pictures came out, they'd think to themselves that there was something about me they never liked. They just couldn't put their finger on it. People don't find it very sympathetic or endearing, a woman who puts herself first. Nor do people respect a man who can't keep his wife in line. So it didn't look good for Don, either. "I need to talk to Don," I said, standing up. "Harry, can you have Dr. Lopani ring my house this evening? Sometime around 6? "Why?" "I need him to call me, and when Paula answers, he needs to sound serious, like he has very important news to tell me. He has to sound concerned enough for her to be intrigued." "Okay." "Evelyn, what are you up to?" Celia said, looking up at me. "When I get on the phone, he has to say exactly this," I said, and I took a piece of paper and started scribbling. Harry read it and then handed the paper to Celia. She looked at me. There was a knock on the door, and without even being welcomed, Don came in. "I've been looking all over for you," he said. His voice showed neither anger nor affection. But I knew Don, and I knew that with him there was no lukewarm. The absence of warmth was a chill. "I assume you've read this bullshit?" He had the magazine in his hand. "I have a plan," I said. "You're goddamn right you have a plan. Somebody better have a plan. I'm not walking around this town looking like a henpecked asshole. Cameron, what happened here?"
"I'm dealing with it, Don."
"Good. But in the meantime, I think you should hear Evelyn's plan. I think it's important you're on board before she moves forward." Don took a seat in the chair opposite Celia. He nodded at her. "Celia?"
"Don?"
"With all due respect, I feel like this is a matter for the three of us to discuss," he said. "Of course," Celia said, stepping up from the chair. "No," I said, putting my hand out to stop her. "Stay." Don looked at me. "She's my friend." Don rolled his eyes and shrugged. "So what's the plan, Evelyn?"
"I'm going to fake a miscarriage."
"What on earth for?"
"They'll hate me and probably lose respect for you if they think I won't give you a baby," I said, despite the fact that it was exactly what was going on between us. That was the elephant in the room, of course. That was all sort of true.
"But they'll pity you both if they think she can't," Celia said. "Pity? What are you talking about, pity? I don't want to be pitied. There's no power in pity. You can't sell movies with pity."
And then Harry spoke up and said, "Like hell you can't."
When the phone rang at 6:10, Paula answered and then rushed into the bedroom to tell me the doctor was calling. I picked up the line with Don beside me. Dr. Lopani read the script written for him. I started crying as loudly as I could on the off chance that Paula had decided to mind her own business for once. A half hour later, Don went downstairs and told Paula we had to let her go. He wasn't nice about it. In fact, he was just mean enough to piss her off. "Because you might run to the tabloids to tell them about the miscarriage of your employers. But you'll definitely run to the tabloids and tell them about the miscarriage of the people who just fired you."
Sub Rosa, June 29th, 1959. Bless Dawn and Evelyn. They need it. The couple who has everything but can't have what they truly want. In the home of Dawn Adler and Evelyn Hugo, things are not what they seem. It may appear that Evelyn is putting off Dawn's advances when it comes to baby-making, but the truth turns out to be quite a different tale. Because all this time we thought Evelyn was pushing Dawn away, it turns out she was working overtime. Evelyn and Dawn desperately want a little Dawn and Evelyn running around the house, but nature has not been kind. It seems every time they find themselves in the family way, things take a sad turn, a tragedy that has befallen them this month for the third time. Let's send Dawn and Evelyn our best wishes. It just goes to show that money can't buy happiness, folks.
The night after the new article came out, Don was not convinced that it had been the right move, and Harry was busy but wouldn't say with what, which I knew meant he was seeing someone. And I wanted to celebrate. So Celia came over to the house and we split a bottle of wine. "You've got no maid," Celia said as she was searching around the kitchen for a corkscrew. "No," I said, sighing. "Not until the studio is done vetting all the applicants." Celia found the corkscrew, and I handed her a bottle of Cabernet. I never spent much time in the kitchen, and it was sort of surreal to be there without someone looking over my shoulder, offering to make me a sandwich or find whatever I was looking for. When you are rich, parts of your house don't really feel like they are yours. The kitchen was one of them for me. I looked through my own cabinets, trying to remember where the wine glasses were. "Ah," I said when I found them, "here." Celia looked at what I was handing her. "Those are champagne flutes." "Oh, right," I said, putting them back where I'd found them. "We had two other sizes. I showed one of each to Celia." "Which?" "The rounder. Do you not know glassware?" "Glassware, serving ware, I don't know any of it. Remember, honey, I'm new money." Celia laughed as she poured our drinks. "I've either not been able to afford it or have been so rich someone would do it for me. Never anywhere in between." "I love that about you," Celia said as she took a full glass and handed it to me. She took the other for herself. "I've had money my whole life. My parents act as if there is a recognized nobility in Georgia, and all of my brothers and sisters, with the exception of my older brother Robert, are just like my parents. My sister Rebecca thinks my being in movies is an embarrassment to the family. Not so much because of the Hollywood aspect, but because I'm working. She says it's undignified. I love them and I hate them, but that's family, I guess." "I don't know," I said. "I don't have much family. Any, really. My father and the rest of the relatives I had back in Hell's Kitchen had not succeeded in contacting me, if they had even tried at all. And I hadn't lost one night of sleep thinking about them." Celia looked at me. She appeared to neither pity me nor feel uncomfortable for all that she'd had growing up that I didn't have. "All the more reason for me to admire you the way I do," she said. "Everything you have, you went out and got for yourself." Celia leaned her glass into mine and clinked. "To you," she said, "for being absolutely unstoppable." I laughed and then drank with her. "Come," I said, leading her out of the kitchen and into the living room. I put my drink down on the hairpin leg coffee table and walked over to the record player. I pulled out Billie Holiday's Lady in Satin from the bottom of the stack. Don hated Billie Holiday, but Don wasn't there. "Do you know her real name is Eleonora Fagan?" I said to Celia. "Billie Holiday is just so much prettier." I sat down on one of our blue tufted sofas. Celia sat on the one opposite me. She folded her legs underneath her, her spare hand on her feet. "What's yours?" she asked. "Is it really Evelyn Hugo?" I grabbed my wine glass and confessed the truth. "Herrera. Evelyn Herrera." Celia didn't react, really. She didn't say, "So you are Latin," or, "I knew you were faking it," as I feared she might be thinking. She didn't say that it explained why my skin was darker than hers or Don's. In fact, she said nothing at all until she said, "That's beautiful." "And yours?" I asked. I stood up and moved over to the couch where she was sitting to close the gap between us. "Celia St. James." "Jameson." "What?"
Cecilia Jameson. That's my real name. That's a great name. Why did they change it?
I changed it.
Why?
Because it sounds like a girl who might live next door to you. And I've always wanted to be the kind of girl you feel lucky just to lay your eyes on.
She tilted her head back and finished her wine.
Like you.
Oh, stop. You stop. You know damn well what you are, how you affect the people around you. I'd kill for a chest like that and full lips like yours. You make people think of undressing you just by showing up in a room fully clothed.
I felt flushed hearing her talk about me like that, having her talk about the way men saw me. I'd never heard a woman talk about me that way before.
Celia took my glass out of my hand. She threw the wine back into her own throat.
"We need more," she said, waving the glass in the air.
I smiled and took both glasses into the kitchen. Celia followed me. She leaned against my formica counter as I poured.
"The first time I saw father and daughter, do you know what I thought?" she said.
Billie Holiday was now faintly playing in the background.
"What?" I said, handing her her glass.
She took it and put it down for a moment, then hopped up onto the counter and picked it up. She was wearing dark blue capri pants and a white sleeveless turtleneck.
"I thought you were the most gorgeous woman who had ever been created, and we should all stop trying."
She inhaled half the contents of her glass.
"No, you did not," I said.
"Yes, I did." I took a sip of my wine.
"It makes no sense," I told her. "You admiring me like you're any different. You're a knockout, plain and simple, with your big blue eyes and your hourglass figure. I think together we really give the guys a wild sight."
Celia smiled.
"Thank you."
I finished my glass and put it down on the counter. Celia took it as a challenge to do the same with hers. She wiped her mouth with her fingertips when she was done. I poured us more.
"How did you learn all the underhanded, sneaky stuff you know?" Celia asked.
"I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about," I said coyly.
"You're smarter than you let on to just about anybody."
"Me?" I said. Celia was starting to get goosebumps, so I suggested we go back into the living room where it was warmer. The desert winds had swooped in and turned this June night into a chilly one. When I started to get cold, too, I asked her if she knew how to make a fire.
"I've seen people do it," she said, shrugging.
"Me, too, I've seen Don do it, but I've never done it."
"We can do it," she said. "We can do anything."
"All right," I said. "You go open another bottle of wine, and I'll start trying to guess how to get it started."
"Great idea."
Celia flung the blanket off her shoulders and ran into the kitchen. I knelt down in front of the fireplace and started poking the ashes, and then I took two logs and laid them perpendicular to each other.
"We need newspaper," she said when she came back,
"and I've decided there's no point in glasses anymore." I looked up to see her swigging the wine out of the bottle. I laughed, grabbed the newspaper off the table, and threw it in.
"Even better," I said, and I ran upstairs and grabbed the copy of Sub Rosa that had called me a cold bitch. I raced back down to show her. "We'll burn this." I threw the magazine into the fireplace and lit a match.
"Do it," she said. "Burn those jerks."
The flame curled the pages, held steady for a moment, and then sputtered out. I lit another match and threw it in. I somehow managed a few embers and then a very small flame as some of the newspaper caught.
"All right," I said. "I feel confident that this is slowly coming along."
Celia came over and handed me the bottle of wine. I took it and sipped from it.
"You have a little catching up to do," she said as I tried to give it back to her.
I laughed and put the bottle back up to my lips. It was expensive wine. I liked drinking it as if it was water, as if it meant nothing to me. Poor girls from Hell's Kitchen can't drink this kind of wine and treat it like it's nothing.
"All right, give it back," Celia said. I teasingly held on to it, not letting it out of my grasp. Her hand was on mine. She pulled with the same force I did, and then I said, "Okay, it's all yours." But I said it too late, and I let go too soon. Wine went all over her white shirt. "Oh, God," I said, "I'm sorry." I took the bottle, put it down on the table, took her hand, and pulled her up the stairs. "You can borrow a shirt. I have just the perfect one for you." I led her into my bedroom and straight into my closet. I watched as Celia looked around, taking in the surroundings of the bedroom I shared with Don. "Can I ask you something?" she said. Her voice had an airiness to it, a wistfulness. I thought she might ask me if I believed in ghosts or love at first sight. "Sure," I said. "And you'll promise to tell the truth?" she asked as she took a seat on the corner of the bed. "Not particularly," I said. Celia laughed. "But go ahead and ask the question," I said, "and we'll see." "Do you love him?" she asked. "Don? Who else?" I thought about it. I had loved him once. I'd loved him very much. But did I love him any more? "I don't know," I said. "Is it all for publicity? Are you just in it to be an Adler?" "No," I said, "I don't think so." "What then?" I walked over and sat down on the bed. "It's hard to say I do or don't love him, or to say that I'm with him for one reason over another. I love him, and a lot of the time I hate him. And I'm with him because of his name, but also because we have fun. We used to have fun a lot, and now we still do sometimes. It's hard to explain." "Does he do it for you?" she said. "Yes, very much. Sometimes I find myself aching to be with him so much it embarrasses me. I don't know if a woman is supposed to want a man as much as I find myself wanting Don. Don may have taught me that I was capable of loving someone and desiring him, but he also taught me that you could desire someone even when you don't like him, that you can desire someone especially when you don't like him. I believe today they call it hate-fucking, but it's a crude name for something that is a very human, sensual experience." "Forget I asked," Celia said, standing up from the bed. I could tell she was bothered. "Let me get the shirt," I said, walking toward the dresser. It was one of my favorite shirts, a lilac button-down blouse with a silvery sheen to it. But it didn't fit me well. I could barely fasten it around my chest. Celia was smaller than me, more delicate. "Here," I said, handing it to her. She took it from me and looked at it. "The color is gorgeous." "I know," I said. "I stole it from the set of Father and Daughter, but don't tell anyone." "I hope you know by now that all of your secrets are safe with me," Celia said as she started unbuttoning to put it on. I think for her it was a throwaway line, but it meant a lot to me. Not because she said it, I suppose, but because when she said it, I realized I believed her. "I do," I said. "I do know that. People think that intimacy is about sex, but intimacy is about truth. When you realize you can tell someone your truth, when you can show yourself to them, when you can stand in front of them bare, and their response is, 'You're safe with me.' That's intimacy. And by those standards, that moment with Celia was the most intimate one I'd ever had with anyone. It made me so appreciative, so grateful, that I wanted to wrap my arms around her and never let go." "I'm not sure it will fit me," Celia said. "Try it on. I bet it will, and if it does, it's yours." I wanted to give her a lot of things. I wanted what I had to be hers. I wondered if this was what it felt like to love someone. I already knew what it meant to be in love with someone. I'd felt it, and I'd acted it. But to love someone, to care for them, to throw your lot in with theirs and think, "Whatever happens, it's you and me." "All right," Celia said. She threw the shirt on the bed. As she pulled off her own shirt, I found myself looking at the paleness of the skin stretched across her ribs. I gazed at the bright whiteness of her bra. I noticed the way her breasts, instead of being lifted by the bra like mine, appeared as if the bra were there merely for decoration. I followed the tiny trail of dark brown freckles that ran along the side of her right hip.
"Well, hello," Don said.
I jumped. Celia gasped and scrambled to put her shirt back on. Don started laughing.
"What on earth is going on in here?" he teased.
I walked over to him and said, "Absolutely nothing."
Photo moment, November 2nd, 1959. Life of the Party Girl. Celia St. James is really making a name for herself around town, and it's not just because she's proving to be a swell actress. The Georgia Peach knows how to make all the right friends, the most high profile of which is everyone's favorite starlet, Evelyn Hugo. Celia and Evelyn have been seen all over town, shopping, chatting, and even finding time for a round or two of ladies' golf at the Beverly Hills Golf Club. And to make matters even more perfect, it seems the best friends will be going on plenty of double dates in the near future. Celia has been spotted at the Trocadero with none other than Robert Logan, close friend of Evelyn's hubby, Don Adler. A handsome date, glamorous friends, and talk of a statuette in her future. It's a good time to be Celia St. James.
"I don't want to do this," Celia said. She was wearing a tailored black dress with a deep V neckline. It was the kind of dress I could never wear out of the house or I'd be picked up on a prostitution charge. She had on a diamond necklace that Don had persuaded Sunset to loan to her. Sunset wasn't in the business of helping freelance actresses, but Celia wanted the diamonds, and I wanted Celia to have anything she wanted. And Don wanted me to have anything I wanted, at least most of the time. Don had just starred in his second Western, The Righteous, after he had lobbied Ari Sullivan hard for one more crack at bat. This time, however, the reviews were telling a different story. Don had manned up. He was convincing everyone on his sophomore try that he was a formidable action star, which translated into Don having the number one movie in the country and Ari Sullivan giving Don anything he asked for. That's how those diamonds made their way onto Celia's neck, the large center ruby resting at the top of her breasts. I was in emerald green again. It was a look that was starting to become my signature. This time it was off the shoulder and made of a pot de soie with a cinched waist, full skirt, and beading on the neckline. My hair was down in a brushed under bob. I looked over at Celia, who was looking in the mirror at my vanity, fiddling with her bouffant. "You have to do this," I said. "I don't want to. Doesn't that count for anything?" I picked up my clutch, made to match my dress. "Not really," I said. "You're not the boss of me, you know," she said. "Why are we friends?" I asked her. "Honestly, I don't even remember," she said. "Because our whole is greater than the sum of our parts." "And so what?" "And so, when it comes to what acting roles to take and how to play them, who's in charge?" "I am." "And now, when it's the opening of our movie, who's in charge then?" "I suppose you are." "You suppose, right." "I really hate him, Evelyn," Celia said. She was messing with her makeup. "Put the rouge down," I said. "Gwen made you look gorgeous. Don't mess with perfect."
"Did you listen to me? I said I hate him."
"Of course you hate him. He's a weasel."
"There's no one else?"
"Not at this hour."
"And I can't go alone?"
"To your own premiere?
Why can't you and I just go together?"
"I'm going with Don. You're going with Robert."
Celia frowned and turned back to the mirror. I saw her eyes narrow and her lips purse, as if she was thinking of how mad she was. I grabbed her bag and handed it to her. It was time to go. Celia, would you cut it out? If you're not willing to do what it takes to get your name in the paper, then why the hell are you here? She stood up, ripped the bag out of my hand, and walked out the door. I watched her go down my stairs into my living room with a grand smile and then run into Robert's arms as if she thought he was the savior of all mankind. I walked up to Don. He always cleaned up nicely in his tux. There was no denying that he was going to be the most handsome man there. But I was tiring of him. What's that saying, behind every gorgeous woman there's a man sick of screwing her? Well, it works both ways. No one mentions that part.
Shall we go? Celia said, as if she couldn't possibly wait to show up to the movie on Robert's arm.
She was a great actress. No one has ever denied that.
I don't want to waste a minute more, I said, looping my arm into Don's and holding on for dear life.
He looked down at my arm and then at me as if pleasantly surprised by my warmth.
Let's see our Little Women in Little Women, shall we? Don said.
I nearly smacked him across the face. He was owed a smack or two, or 15. Our cars picked us up and drove us to Grauman's Chinese Theater. Parts of Hollywood Boulevard had been blocked off for our arrival. The driver pulled up just behind Celia and Robert outside the theater. We were the last in a line of four cars. When you are one of an ensemble of female stars in a movie, and the studio wants to make a big show, they make sure you all show up at the same time in four separate cars with four eligible bachelors for dates. Except in my case, the eligible bachelor was my husband. Our dates stepped out first, each standing by and offering a hand. I waited as I watched Ruby step out, then Joy, then Celia. I waited just a beat longer than the rest of them, and then I stepped out, leg first, onto the red carpet.
You're the most beautiful woman here, Don said into my ear as I stood next to him.
But I already knew he thought I was the most gorgeous woman there. I knew very acutely that if he did not believe that, he would not have been with me. Men were almost never with me for my personality. I'm not suggesting that charming girls should take pity on the pretty ones. I'm just saying it's not so great being loved for something you didn't do. The photographers started calling our names as we all walked in. My head was a jumble of words being thrown in my direction. Ruby, Joy, Celia, Evelyn, Mr. and Mrs. Adler, over here. I could barely hear myself think over the din of cameras snapping and the crowd buzzing, but as I had long ago trained myself to do, I pretended as if I felt perfectly calm inside, as if being treated like a tiger at the zoo was my most comfortable situation. Don and I held hands and smiled for every flashing bulb. At the end of the red carpet stood a few men with microphones. Ruby was speaking to one, Joy and Celia were speaking to another. The third put his mic in my face. He was a short guy, with small eyes and a bulbous, gin-blossomed nose. A face made for radio, as they say. Miss Hugo, are you excited for this picture to come out? I laughed as kindly as I could to disguise what a stupid question he was asking. I've waited my whole life to play Joe March. I'm incredibly excited for tonight. And you seem to have made a good friend during filming, he said. What's that? You and Celia St. James, you seem like you're great friends. She's wonderful, and wonderful in the film, absolutely. She and Robert Logan seem to be getting hot and heavy. Oh, you'd have to ask them about that, I don't know. But didn't you set them up? Don stepped in. I think that's all for questions, he said. Don, when are you and the missus going to start a family? I said it was enough, friend, and it's enough, thank you. Don pushed me forward. We got to the doors, and I watched as Ruby and her date, followed by Joy and hers, walked through. Don opened the door in front of us, waiting for me. Robert held the one on the other side for Celia, and I got an idea. I took Celia's hand and turned us around. "Wave to the crowd," I said, smiling, "like we're the goddamn queens of England." Celia smiled brightly and did exactly as I did. We stood there in black and green, redhead and blonde, one of us all ass and the other all tits, waving to the crowd as if we ruled them. Ruby and Joy were nowhere to be seen, and the crowd roared for us. We turned around and headed into the theater. We made our way to our seats. "Big moment," Don said. "I know. In just a few months, you'll win for this, and I'll win for the righteous, and then the sky's the limit." "Celia is going to be nominated, too," I whispered into his ear. "People are going to leave this movie talking about you," he said. "I have no doubt." I looked over to see Robert whispering into Celia's ear. She was laughing as if he actually had anything funny to say, but it was me who got her those diamonds, me who got her that gorgeous picture of the two of us that would make headlines the next day. Meanwhile, she was acting as if he was about to charm her dress off. All I could think was that he didn't know about that line of freckles on her hip. I knew about them, and he didn't. "She's really talented, Don." "Oh, get over her," Don said. "I'm sick of hearing her name all the damn time. They shouldn't be asking you about her. They should be asking you about us." "Don, I..." He waved me off, determining before I'd even said anything that whatever I had to say was useless to him. The lights dimmed, the crowd quieted, the credits started to roll, and my face appeared on the screen. The entire audience stared at me on screen as I said, "Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents." But by the time Celia said, "We've got father and mother and each other," I knew it was all over for me. Everyone was going to walk out of this theater talking about Celia St. James. It should have made me afraid or jealous or insecure. I should have been plotting to one-up her in some way by planting a story that she was a prude or sleeping around. That is the fastest way to ruin a woman's reputation, after all, to imply that she has not adequately threaded the needle that is being sexually satisfying without ever appearing to desire sexual satisfaction. But instead of spending the next hour and 45 minutes nursing my wounds, I spent the time holding back a smile. Celia was going to win an Oscar. It was as plain as the nose on her face, and it didn't make me jealous, it made me happy. When Beth died, I cried, and then I reached over Robert's and Don's laps and squeezed her hand. Don rolled his eyes at me, and I thought, he's going to find an excuse to hit me later. But it will be for this. I was standing in the middle of Ari Sullivan's mansion at the top of Benedict Canyon. Don and I had made it up the winding streets without saying much of anything to each other. I suspected he knew the same thing I did once he saw Celia in that movie, that no one cared about anything else. After our driver dropped us off and we made our way inside, Don said, "I need to find the John," and disappeared. I looked for Celia, but couldn't find her. Instead, I was surrounded by brown-nosing losers, hoping to rub elbows with me while they drank their sugary cocktails and talked about Eisenhower. "Would you excuse me?" I said to a woman in a hideous bubble cut. She was waxing on about the Hope Diamond. Women who collected rare jewels seemed exactly the same as men who were desperate to have just one night with me. The world was about objects to them. All they wanted to do was possess. "Oh, there you are, Ev," Ruby said when she found me in the hallway. She had two green cocktails in her hand. Her voice was lukewarm, a bit hard to read, Having a good night? I asked. She looked over her shoulder, put the stems of both glasses in one hand, and then pulled me by the elbow, spilling as she did. Ow, Ruby, I said, noticeably perturbed. She nodded covertly to the laundry room to the right of us. What on earth? I said. Would you just open the goddamn door, Evelyn? I turned the handle and Ruby stepped in and dragged me with her. She shut the door behind us. Here, she said, handing me one of the cocktails in the dark. I was getting it for Joy, but you have it. It matches your dress anyway. As my eyes adjusted, I took the drink from her. You're lucky it matches my dress. You nearly poured half the drink on it. With one of her hands now free, Ruby tugged on the pull chain of the light above us. The tiny room lit up and stung my eyes. You have absolutely no decorum tonight, Ruby. You think I'm worried about what you think of me, Evelyn Hugo? Now listen, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about what? About what? About Celia St. James, that's what. What about her? Ruby hung her head in frustration. Evelyn, I swear. She gave a great performance. What can we do? I said. This is exactly what I told Harry would happen, and he said it wouldn't. Well, what do you want me to do about it? You're losing out, too. Or do you not see that? Of course I see it. I cared, obviously, but I also knew I could still win Best Actress. Celia and Ruby would be competing for Best Supporting. I don't know what to tell you, Ruby. We were all right about Celia. She's talented and gorgeous and charming, and when you've been bested, sometimes it's good to recognize it and move on. Ruby looked at me as if I had slapped her. I had nothing else to say, and she was blocking my way out of the room, so I put the drink to my mouth and downed it in two gulps. This is not the Evelyn I know and respect, Ruby said. Oh, Ruby, put a lid on it. She finished her drink. People have been saying all sorts of things about the two of you, and I didn't believe it, but now, I don't know. People have been saying all sorts of things like what? You know. I assure you I haven't the faintest. Why do you make things so difficult? Ruby, you've pulled me into a laundry room against my will, and you're barking at me about things I can't control. I'm not the difficult one. She's a lesbian, Evelyn. Until that point, the sounds of the party going on around us had been muted but still distinct. But the minute Ruby said what she said, the minute I heard the word lesbian, my blood started beating so fast that my pulse was all I could hear. I was not paying attention to what was flying out of Ruby's mouth. I could only catch certain words like girl and dyke and twisted. The skin on my chest felt hot. My ears burned. I did my best to calm myself, and when I focused on Ruby's words, I finally heard the other piece of what she was trying to tell me. You should probably get a better handle on your husband, by the way. He's in Ari's bedroom getting a blowjob from some harpy from MGM. When she said it, I did not think, oh my God, my husband is cheating on me. I thought, I have to find Celia.
Evelyn gets up off the sofa and picks up the phone, asking Grace to order us dinner from the Mediterranean place on the corner.
Monique, what would you like, beef or chicken?
Chicken, I guess.
I watch her, waiting for her to sit back down and resume her story. But when she does sit, she merely looks at me. She neither acknowledges what she's just told me, nor admits what I've been suspecting for some time now. I have no choice but to be direct. Did you know?
Did I know what?
That Celia St. James was gay.
I'm telling you the story as it unfolded.
Well, yes, I say, but...
But what?
Evelyn is calm, perfectly composed. And I can't tell if it's because she knows what I suspect and she's finally ready to tell the truth, or because I'm dead wrong, and so she has no idea what I'm thinking. I'm not sure I want to ask the question before I know the answer. Evelyn's lips are together in a straight line. Her eyes are focused directly on me, but I notice as she's waiting for me to speak that her chest is rising and falling at a rapid pace. She's nervous. She's not as confident as she's letting on. She's an actress, after all. I should know well enough by now that what you see isn't always what you get with Evelyn. So I ask her the question in a way that lets her tell me as much or as little as she's ready to say. Who was the love of your life? Evelyn looks me in the eye, and I know she needs one more tiny push. It's okay, Evelyn, really. It's a big deal, but it is okay. Things are different now from how they were then, although still not entirely safe either, I have to admit. But still, she can say it. She can say it to me. She can admit it freely, now, here. Evelyn, who was your great love? You can tell me. Evelyn looks out the window, breathes in deeply, and then says, Celia St. James. The room is quiet as Evelyn lets herself hear her own words. And then she smiles, a bright, wide, deeply sincere smile. She starts laughing to herself and then refocuses on me. I feel like I spent my entire life loving her. So this book, your biography, you're ready to come out as a gay woman? Evelyn closes her eyes for a moment, and at first I think she's processing the weight of what I've said, but once she opens her eyes again, I realize she is trying to process my stupidity. Haven't you been listening to a single thing I've told you? I loved Celia, but I also, before her, loved Don. In fact, I'm positive that if Don hadn't turned out to be a spectacular asshole, I probably never would have been capable of falling in love with someone else at all. I'm bisexual. Don't ignore half of me so you can fit me into a box, Monique. Don't do that. This stings. Hard. I know how it feels for people to assume things about you, to prescribe a label for you based on how you appear to them. I have spent my life trying to explain to people that while I look black, I am biracial. I've spent my life knowing the importance of allowing people to tell you who they are instead of reducing them to labels. And here I've gone and done to Evelyn what so many people have done to me. Her love affair with a woman signaled to me that she was gay, and I did not wait for her to tell me she was bisexual. This is her whole point, isn't it? This is why she wants to be so acutely understood, with such perfect word choices, because she wants to be seen exactly as she truly is, with all the nuance and shades of gray, the same way I have wanted to be seen. So, this is my fuck-up. I just fucked up. And despite my desire to blow past it or to reduce it to nothing, I know the stronger move here is to apologize. I'm sorry. I say, you're absolutely right. I should have asked you how you identify instead of assuming I knew. So let me try again. Are you prepared to come out in the pages of this book? As a bisexual woman. Yes, she says, nodding. Yes, I am. Evelyn seems pleased with my apology, if not still slightly indignant. But we are back in business. And how exactly did you figure it out, I ask, that you loved her? After all, you could have found out she was interested in women and just as easily not realized you were interested in her. Well, it helped that my husband was upstairs cheating on me, because I was sickeningly jealous on both accounts. I was jealous when I found out Celia was gay, because it meant that she was with other women, or had been with other women,
that her life wasn't just me. And I was jealous that my husband was with a woman upstairs at the very party I was at, because it was embarrassing and threatened my way of life. I'd been living in this world where I thought I could have this closeness with Celia and this distance with Dawn, and neither of them would need anything else from anyone else. It was this odd bubble that just up and burst.
I would imagine back then it wasn't a conclusion you'd come to easily, being in love with someone of the same sex.
Of course not. Maybe if I'd spent my whole life fighting off feelings for women, then I might have had a template for it, but I didn't. I was taught to like men, and I had found, albeit temporarily, love and lust with a man. The fact that I wanted to be around Celia all the time, the fact that I cared about her enough that I valued her happiness over my own, the fact that I liked to think about that moment when she stood in front of me without her shirt on. Now, you put those pieces together, and you say, 1 + 1 = I'm in love with a woman. But back then, at least for me, I didn't have that equation. And if you don't even realize that there's a formula to be working with, how the hell are you supposed to find the answer? She goes on. I thought I finally had a friendship with a woman, and I thought my marriage was down the tubes because my husband was an asshole. And by the way, both those things were true. They just weren't the whole truth.
So what did you do?
At the party?
Yeah. Who did you go to first?
Well, Evelyn says, one of them came to me.
Ruby left me there, next to the dryer, with an empty cocktail glass in my hand. I needed to go back to the party, but I stood there frozen, thinking, get out of here. I just couldn't turn the doorknob. And then the door opened on its own. Celia, the raucous, bright-lit party behind her. Evelyn, what are you doing? How did you find me? I ran into Ruby, and she said I could find you drinking in the laundry room. I thought it was a euphemism. It wasn't. I can see that. Do you sleep with women? I asked. Celia, shocked, shut the door behind her. What are you talking about? Ruby says you're a lesbian. Celia looked over my shoulder. Who cares what Ruby says? Are you? Are you going to stop being friends with me now? Is that what this is about? No, I said, shaking my head. Of course not. I would never do that. I would never. What then? I just want to know, is all. Why? Don't you think I have the right to know? Depends. So you are, I asked. Celia put her hand on the doorknob and prepared to leave. Instinctively, I leaned forward and grabbed her wrist. What are you doing? She said. I liked the feel of her wrist in my hand. I liked the way her perfume permeated the whole tiny room. I leaned forward and kissed her. I did not know what I was doing. And by that I mean that I was not fully in control of my movement, and that I was physically unaware of how to kiss her. Should it be the way I kissed men, or should it be different somehow? I also did not understand the emotional scope of my actions. I did not truly understand their significance or risk. I was a famous woman kissing a famous woman in the house of the biggest studio head in Hollywood, surrounded by producers and stars, and probably a good dozen people who ratted to Sub Rosa magazine. But all I cared about in that moment was that her lips were soft. Her skin was without any roughness whatsoever. All I cared about was that she kissed me back, that she took her hand off the doorknob and instead put it on my waist. She smelled floral, like lilac powder, and her lips felt humid, Her breath was sweet, spiked with the taste of cigarettes and creme de menthe. When she pushed herself against me, when our chests touched and her pelvis grazed mine, all I could think was that it wasn't so different, and yet it was different entirely. She swelled in all the places Don went flat. She was flat in the places Don swelled. And yet that sense that you can feel your heart in your chest, that your body tells you it wants more, that you lose yourself in the scent, taste, and feel of another person, it was all the same. Celia broke away first. "We can't stay in here," she said. She wiped her lips on the back of her hand. She took her thumb and rubbed it against the bottom of mine. "Wait, Celia," I said, trying to stop her. But she left the room, shutting the door behind her. I closed my eyes, unsure how to get a handle on myself, how to quiet my brain. I breathed in. I opened the door and walked right up the steps, taking them two at a time. I opened every single door on the second floor until I found who I was looking for. Don was getting dressed, shoving the tail of his shirt into his suit pants, as a woman in a beaded gold dress put her shoes on. I ran out, and Don followed me. "Let's talk about this at home," he said, grabbing my elbow. I yanked it away, searching for Celia. There was no sign of her. Harry came in through the front door, fresh-faced and looking sober. I ran up to him, leaving Don on the staircase, cornered by a tipsy producer wanting to talk to him about a melodrama. "Where have you been all night?" I asked Harry. He smiled. "I'm going to keep that to myself. Can you take me home?" Harry looked at me and then at Don, still on the stairs. "You're not going home with your husband?" I shook my head. "Does he know that? If he doesn't, he's a moron." "Okay," Harry said, nodding with confidence and submission. Whatever I wanted was what he would do. I got into the front seat of Harry's Chevy, and he started backing out just as Don came out of the house. He ran to my side of the car. I did not roll down the window. "Evelyn!" he yelled. I liked how the glass between us took the edge off his voice, how it muffled it enough to make him sound far away. I liked the control of being able to decide whether I listened to him at full volume. "I'm sorry," he said. "It isn't what you think." I stared straight ahead. "Let's go." I was putting Harry in a tough spot, making him take sides. But to Harry's credit, he didn't bat an eyelash. "Cameron, don't you dare take my wife away from me." "Don, let's discuss it in the morning," Harry called through the window, and then he plowed out into the roads of the canyon. When we got to Sunset Boulevard and my pulse had slowed, I turned to Harry and started talking. When I told him that Don had been upstairs with a woman, he nodded as if he'd expected no less. "Why don't you seem surprised?" I asked as we sped through the intersection of Doheny and Sunset, the very spot where the beauty of Beverly Hills started to show. The streets widened and became lined with trees, and the lawns were immaculately manicured, the sidewalks clean. "Don has always had a penchant for women he's just met," Harry says. "I wasn't sure if you knew or if you cared." "I didn't know. And I do care." "Well, then, I'm sorry," he said, looking at me briefly before putting his eyes back on the road. "In that case, I should have told you." "I suppose there are lots of things we don't tell each other," I said, looking out the window. There was a man walking his dog down the street. I needed someone. Right then, I needed a friend. Someone to tell my truths to. Someone to accept me. Someone to say that I was going to be okay. "What if we really did it?" I said. "Told each other the truth? Told each other everything?" Harry looked at me. "I'd say that's a burden I don't want to put on you." It might be a burden for you, too, I said. I have skeletons.
You're Cuban, and you're a power-hungry, calculating bitch, Harry said, smiling at me. Those secrets aren't so bad.
I threw my head back and laughed.
And you know what I am, he said.
I do.
But right now you have plausible deniability. You don't have to hear about it or see it.
Harry turned left, into the flats instead of the hills. He was taking me to his house instead of my own. He was scared of what Don would do to me. I sort of was, too.
Maybe I'm ready for that. To be a real friend, true blue, I said.
I'm not sure that's a secret I want you to have to keep, love. It's a sticky one.
I think that secret's much more common than either of us is pretending, I said. I think maybe all of us have at least a little bit of that secret within us. I think I just might have that secret in me, too.
Harry took a right and pulled into his driveway. He put the car in park and turned to me.
You're not like me, Evelyn.
I might be a little, I said. I might be. And Celia might be, too.
Harry turned back to the wheel, thinking.
Yes, he said finally. Celia might be, too.
You knew?
I suspected, he said. And I suspected she might have feelings for you.
I felt like I was the last person on Earth to know what was right in front of me.
I'm leaving Don, I said. Harry nodded, unsurprised.
I'm happy to hear it, he said, but I hope you know the full extent of what it means.
I know what I'm doing, Harry.
I was wrong. I didn't know what I was doing.
Don's not going to take it sitting down, Harry said. That's all I mean.
So I should continue this charade? Allow him to sleep around and hit me when he feels like it?
Absolutely not. You know I would never say that.
Then what?
I want you to be prepared for what you're going to do. I don't want to talk about this anymore, I said.
That's fine, Harry said.
He opened his car door and got out. He came around to my side and opened my door.
Come, Ev, he said kindly.
He put his hand out. It's been a long night. You need some rest.
I suddenly felt very tired. As if once he pointed it out, I realized it had been there all along.
I followed Harry to his front door.
His living room was sparse but handsome, furnished with wood and leather. The alcoves and doorways were all arched, the walls stark white. Only a single piece of art hung on the wall, a red and blue Rothko above the sofa. It occurred to me then that Harry wasn't a Hollywood producer for the paycheck. Sure, his house was nice, but there wasn't anything ostentatious about it, nothing performative. It was merely a place to sleep for him.
Harry was like me. Harry was in it for the glory. He was in it because it kept him busy, kept him important, kept him sharp.
Harry, like me, had gotten into it for the ego.
And we were both fortunate that we'd found our humanity in it, even though it appeared to be somewhat by accident.
The two of us walked up the curved stairs, and Harry set me up in his guest room. The bed had a thin mattress with a heavy wool blanket. I used a bar of soap to wash my makeup off, and Harry gently unzipped the back of my dress for me and gave me a pair of his pajamas to wear.
I'll be just next door if you need anything, he said.
Thank you for everything.
Harry nodded. He turned away and then turned back to me as I was folding down the blanket.
Our interests aren't aligned, Evelyn, he said.
Yours and mine. You see that, right?
I looked at him, trying to determine if I did see it.
My job is to make the studio money. And if you are doing what the studio wants, then my job is to make you happy. But more than anything, Ari wants to make Don happy.
Harry looked me in the eye. I got the point. Okay, I said. I see it. Harry smiled shyly and closed the door behind him. You'd think I'd have tossed and turned all night, worried about the future, worried about what it meant that I had kissed a woman, worried about whether I should really leave Don. But that's what denial is for. The next morning, Harry drove me back to my house. I was bracing myself for a fight, but when I got there, Don was nowhere to be seen. I knew that very moment that our marriage was over, and that the decision, the one I thought was mine to make, had been made for me. Don hadn't been waiting for me, hadn't been planning to fight for me. Don was off somewhere else, leaving me before I could leave him. Instead, right on my doorstep, was Celia St. James. Harry waited in the driveway until I made my way up to her. I turned and waved for him to go. When he was gone, and my beautiful tree-lined street was as quiet as you'd expect in Beverly Hills at just past 7 in the morning, I took Celia's hand and led her inside. I'm not a... Celia said when I shut the door behind us. There was a girl in high school, my best friend, and she and I... I don't want to hear about it, I said. Okay, she said. There's nothing wrong with me. I know there's nothing wrong with you. She looked at me, looking to understand exactly what I wanted from her, exactly what she should confess. Here is what I know, I said. I know that I used to love Don. I know that, she said defensively. I know you love Don. I've always known that. I said, I used to love Don, but I don't think I've loved him for some time now. Okay? Now the only person I think about is you. And with that, I went upstairs and packed my bags. I hid out in Celia's apartment for a week and a half, in purgatory. Celia and I slept, chastely, side by side in her bed every night. During the day, I stayed in her apartment and read books while she went to work on her new movie for Warner Brothers. We did not kiss. We occasionally lingered a little too long when our arms brushed, when our hands touched, never locking eyes. But in the middle of the night, after we both had appeared to fall asleep, I would feel her body against my back, and I would push myself into her, feeling the warmth of her stomach against me, her chin in the crook of my neck. Some mornings I would wake up in a pile of her hair and inhale deeply, trying to breathe in as much of her as I could. I knew that I wanted to kiss her again. I knew that I wanted to touch her. But I didn't know exactly what I was supposed to do or how it was supposed to work. It was easy to think of that one kiss in a dark laundry room as a fluke. It wasn't even that hard to tell myself that the feelings I had for her were simply platonic. As long as I only indulged my thoughts about Celia sometimes, then I could tell myself it wasn't real. Homosexuals were misfits. And while I didn't think that made them bad people, after all, I loved Harry like a brother, I wasn't ready to be one of them. So I told myself that the spark between Celia and me was just a quirk we had, which was convincing as long as it remained quirky. Sometimes reality comes crashing down on you. Other times reality simply waits patiently for you to run out of the energy it takes to deny it. And that is what happened to me, one Saturday morning when Celia was in the shower and I was making eggs. There was a knock at the door, and when I opened it, I saw the only face I was happy to see on that side of the threshold. "Hi, Harry," I said, leaning in to hug him. I was careful not to get my runny spatula on his nice Oxford shirt. "Look at you," he said, "cooking." "I know," I said as I moved out of the way and invited him in. "Hell has frozen over, I guess. Would you like some eggs?" I led him toward the kitchen. He peeked into the pan. "How well have you mastered breakfast?" he asked. "If you're asking if your eggs will be burned, the answer is probably." Harry smiled and put a large, heavy envelope on the dining room table. The thwop it made as it hit the wood was all the clue I needed to what it contained. "Let me guess," I said, "I'm getting a divorce." "It would appear you are." "On what grounds?" "I assume his lawyers didn't check the boxes for adultery or cruelty." "Abandonment." I raised my eyebrows. "Clever." "The grounds don't matter, you know that." "I know." "You should read through it. Have a lawyer read through it, but there's essentially one big highlight."
"Tell me."
"You get the house, and your money, and half of his." I looked at Harry as if he was trying to sell me the Brooklyn Bridge. Why would he do that?
"Because you are forbidden to talk to anyone at any time about anything that happened during your marriage."
"Is he also forbidden?" Harry shook his head. "Not in writing, no."
"So I can't talk and he can blab all over town. What makes him think I'll go for that?"
Harry looked down at the table for a moment, and then back up at me, sheepish.
"Sunset's dropping me, aren't they?"
"Don wants you out of the studio. Ari's planning to loan you out to MGM in Columbia."
"And then what?"
"And then you're on your own."
"Well, that's fine. I can do that. Celia's freelance. I'll get an agent like her."
"You can," Harry said, "and I think you should try, but..."
"But what?"
"Don wants Ari to blackball you from getting an Oscar nod. And Ari's agreeing to it. I think he's going to loan you out and purposefully put you in flops."
"He can't do that."
"He can. And he will, because Don's the goose that laid the golden egg. The studios are all hurting. People aren't going to the movies as much. They are waiting for the next episode of Gunsmoke. Sunset's been in decline from the minute we were forced to sell off our theaters. We're staying afloat because of stars like Don."
"And stars like me,"
Harry nodded, "but, and I'm sorry to say it, but I think it's important that you see the big picture. Don's worth a lot more asses in the seats than you are."
I felt about 2 inches tall. That hurts.
"I know," Harry said, "and I'm sorry." The water in the bathroom turned off, and I heard Celia step out of the shower. There was a breeze coming in from the window. I wanted to shut it, but I didn't move.
"So that's it. If Don doesn't want me, no one does."
"If Don doesn't want you, he doesn't want anyone else to have you." I realize it's a subtle difference, but it is vaguely reassuring.
"Good."
"So that's his play. Don ruins my life and buys my silence with a house and less than $1 million.
"That's a lot of money," Harry said, as if it mattered, as if it helped.
"You know I don't care about money," I said. "At least not primarily."
"I know."
Celia came out of the bathroom in a robe, her hair wet and straight.
"Oh, hi, Harry," she said. "I'll just be a minute."
"No need to hurry on my account," he said. "I was just leaving." Celia smiled and walked into the bedroom.
"Thank you for bringing it," I said.
Harry nodded.
"I did it once, I can do it again," I said to him as we walked to the door. "I can build the whole thing back up from scratch."
"I have never doubted that you could do a single thing you put your mind to." Harry put his hand on the doorknob, ready to go.
"I'd like it if... I hope that we can still be friends, Evelyn. That we can still..."
"Oh, shut up," I said. "We're best friends, who may or may not tell each other everything. That doesn't change. You still love me, right? Even though I'm about to be on the outs."
"I do. And I still love you, so that's the end of it."
Harry smiled, relieved. "Okay," he said. "It's me and you. Me and you, true blue." Harry walked out of the apartment, and I watched him go down the street and get into his car. Then I turned around and rested my back against the door. I was going to lose everything I had built my life on. Everything except the money. I still had the money. And that was something. And then I realized there was something else waiting for me. Something I wanted that I was free to have. It was there, with my back against the door of her apartment, on the brink of my divorce from the most popular man in Hollywood, that I realized that lying to myself about what I wanted took far more energy than I had. So instead of wondering what it meant and what it made me, I stood up and walked into Celia's room. She was in her robe still, drying her hair in front of her vanity. I walked up to her and looked into her gorgeous blue eyes, and I said, "I think that I love you." And then I took the tie of her robe and pulled it open. I did it slowly. I did it so slowly that she could have stopped me a million times before it broke free. But she didn't. Instead, she sat up straighter, looked at me more boldly, and put her hand on my waist as I did it. The sides of the robe broke free of each other the moment the tension slacked, and then there she was, naked and sitting in front of me. Her skin was creamy and pale. Her breasts were fuller than I'd anticipated, her nipples pink, her flat stomach rounded just the littlest bit underneath her belly button. And when my eyes moved down to her legs, she parted them just the littlest bit. Instinctively, I kissed her. I put my hands on her breasts, touching them the way I wanted to, and then the way I liked my own to be touched. When she moaned, I throbbed. She kissed my neck and the top of my chest. She pulled my shirt off over the top of my head. She looked at me, my breasts exposed. "You're gorgeous," she said, "even more gorgeous than I imagined." I blushed and put my head in my hands, embarrassed by how out of control I felt, how out of my league it all was. She took my hands off my face and looked at me. "I don't know what I'm doing," I said. "It's okay," she said. "I do." That night, Celia and I slept nude, holding each other. We no longer pretended to touch by accident. And when I woke up in the morning with her hair in my face, I inhaled loudly and proudly. Within those four walls, we were unashamed.
Sub Rosa, December 30th, 1959. Adler and Hugo kaput. Don Adler, Hollywood's most eligible bachelor. Don and Evelyn are calling it quits. After 2 years of marriage, Don has filed for divorce from Evelyn Hugo. We are sad to see the lovebirds part ways, but we'd be lying if we said we were surprised. We've heard rumblings that Don's star is set to rise even higher, and Evelyn was getting jealous and catty. Luckily for Don, he's renewed his contract with Sunset Studios, which must have head honcho Ari Sullivan smiling wide and has three films slated for release this year. That Don never misses a beat. Meanwhile, while Evelyn's newest movie, Little Women, showed boffo BO numbers and great critical reception, Sunset has pulled her out of the upcoming Joker's Wild and replaced her with Ruby Riley. Has the sun set on Evelyn's time with Sunset?
How did you remain so confident, so steadfast in your resolve? I ask Evelyn.
When Don left me? Or when my career went down the tubes?
Both, I guess, I say. I mean, you had Celia, so it's a little different, but still. Evelyn cocks her head slightly.
Different from what?
I say, lost in my own thoughts. You said I had Celia, so it was a little different. Evelyn clarifies. Different from what? Sorry, I say. I was in my own head. I have momentarily let my own relationship problems seep into what should be a one-way conversation. Evelyn shakes her head. No need to be sorry, just tell me, different from what? I look at her and realize that I've opened a door that can't really be shut. From my own impending divorce. Evelyn smiles, almost like the Cheshire Cat.
Now things are getting interesting, she says. It bothers me, her cavalier attitude toward my own vulnerability. It's my fault for bringing it up. I know that. But she could treat it with more kindness. I've exposed myself. I've exposed a wound. Have you signed the papers? Evelyn asks. Perhaps with a tiny heart above the I in Monique. That's what I would do. I guess I don't take divorce as lightly as you, I say. It comes out flatly. I consider softening, but I don't. No, of course not, Evelyn says kindly. If you did at your age, you'd be a cynic.
But at your age? I ask.
With my experience? A realist.
That, in and of itself, is awfully cynical, don't you think? Divorce is loss. Evelyn shakes her head.
Heartbreak is loss. Divorce is a piece of paper.
I look down to see that I've been doodling a cube over and over with my blue pen. It is starting to tear through the page. I neither pick up my pen nor push harder. I merely keep running the ink over the lines of the cube.
If you are heartbroken right now, then I feel for you deeply, Evelyn says. That I have the utmost respect for. That's the sort of thing that can split a person in two. But I wasn't heartbroken when Don left me. I simply felt like my marriage had failed. And those are very different things.
When Evelyn says this, I stop my pen in place. I look up at her. And I wonder why I needed Evelyn to tell me that. I wonder why that sort of distinction has never crossed my mind before. On my walk to the subway this evening, I see that Frankie has called me for the second time today. I wait until I've ridden all the way to Brooklyn, and I'm heading down the street toward my apartment to respond. It's almost 9 o'clock, so I decide to text her. Just getting out of Evelyn's now, sorry it's so late, want to talk tomorrow? I have my key in the front door when I get Frankie's response. Tonight is fine, call as soon as you can. I roll my eyes. I should never bluff Frankie. I put my bag down. I pace around the apartment. What am I going to tell her? The way I see it, I have two choices. I can lie and tell her everything's going fine, that we're on track for the June issue, and that I'm getting Evelyn to talk about more concrete things. Or I can tell the truth. And potentially get fired. At this point, I'm starting to see that getting fired might not be so bad. I'll have a book to publish in the future, one for which I'd most likely make millions of dollars. That could, in turn, get me other celebrity biography opportunities. And then, eventually, I could start finding my own topics, write about anything I want with the confidence that any publisher would buy it. But I don't know when this book will be sold. And if my real goal is to set myself up to be able to grab whatever story I want, then credibility matters. Getting fired from Vivant because I stole their major headline would not bode well for my reputation. Before I can decide what exactly my plan is, my phone is ringing in my hand. Frankie Troop. Hello?
Monique,
Frankie says, her voice somehow both solicitous and irritated.
What's going on with Evelyn? Tell me everything.
I keep searching for ways in which Frankie, Evelyn, and I all leave the situation getting what we want. But I realize suddenly that the only thing I can control is that I get what I want. And why shouldn't I, really? Why shouldn't it be me who comes out on top? Frankie, hi. I'm sorry, I haven't been more available. That's fine, that's fine. Frankie says, as long as you're getting good material. I am, but unfortunately, Evelyn is no longer interested in sharing the piece with Vivant. The silence on Frankie's end of the phone is deafening. And then it is punctuated with a flat, dead. What? I've been trying to convince her for days. That's why I've been unable to get back to you. I've been explaining to her that she has to do this piece for Vivant.
If she wasn't interested, why did she call us?
She wanted me, I say. I do not follow this up with any sort of qualification. I do not say, she wanted me and here is why, or she wanted me and I'm so sorry about all this.
She used us to get to you,
Frankie says, as if it's the most insulting thing she can think of. But the thing is, Frankie used me to get to Evelyn, so... Yes, I say. I think she did. She's interested in a full biography written by me. I've gone along with it in the hopes of changing her mind.
A biography? You're taking our story and turning it into a book instead?
It's what Evelyn wants. I've been trying to convince her otherwise.
And have you?
Frankie asks.
Convinced her?
No, I say. Not yet. But I think I might be able to.
Okay,
Frankie says.
Then do that.
This is my moment. I think I can deliver you a massive, headline-making Evelyn Hugo story, I say. But if I do, I want to be promoted. I can hear skepticism enter Frankie's voice.
What kind of promotion?
Editor at large. I come and go as I please. I choose the stories I want to tell.
No.
Then I have no incentive to get Evelyn to allow the piece to be in Vivant. I can practically hear Frankie weighing her options. She is quiet, but there is no tension. It is as if she does not expect me to speak until she has decided what she will say.
If you get us a cover story, she says finally, and she agrees to sit for a photo shoot, I'll make you a writer at large.
I consider the offer, and Frankie jumps in as I'm thinking.
We only have one editor at large. Bumping Gail out of the spot she has earned doesn't feel right to me. I think you could understand that. Writer at large is what I have to give. I won't exert too much control over what you can write about. And if you prove yourself quickly there, you'll move up as everyone else does. It's fair, Monique.
I think about it for a moment further. Writer at large seems reasonable. Writer at large sounds great. Okay, I say. And then I push just a little bit further, because Evelyn said, at the very beginning of all this, that I have to insist on being paid top dollar, and she's right. And I want a raise commensurate with the title. I cringe as I hear myself asking for money so directly. But I relax my shoulders the moment I hear Frankie say, yes, sure, fine. I breathe out.
But I want confirmation from you tomorrow, she continues, and I want the photo shoot booked by next week.
Okay, I say. You've got it. Before Frankie gets off the phone, she says,
I'm impressed, but I'm also pissed off. Please make this so good that I have to forgive you.
Don't worry, I say. I will. When I walk into Evelyn's office the next morning, I'm so nervous that my back is sweating and a shallow pool is forming along my spine. Grace puts down a charcuterie platter, and I can't stop staring at the cornichon as Evelyn and Grace are talking about Lisbon in the summer. The moment Grace is gone, I turn to Evelyn. We need to talk, I say. She laughs.
Honestly? I feel like that's all we do.
About Vivant, I mean.
Okay, she says. Talk.
I need to know some sort of timeline for when this book might be released. I wait for Evelyn to respond. I wait for her to give me something, anything resembling an answer.
I'm listening, she says.
If you don't tell me when this book could realistically be sold, then I'm running the risk of losing my job for something that might be years away, decades even.
You certainly have high hopes for my lifespan.
Evelyn, I say, somewhat discouraged that she still isn't taking this seriously. I either need to know when this is coming out, or I need to promise Vivant an excerpt of it for the June issue. Evelyn thinks. She is sitting cross-legged on the sofa opposite me, in slim black jersey pants, a gray shell tank, and an oversized white cardigan.
Okay, she says, nodding. You can give them a piece of it, whatever piece you like, for the June issue. If, and only if, you shut up about this timeline business.
I don't let my joy show on my face. I'm halfway there. I can't rest until I'm done. I have to push her. I have to ask and be willing to be told no. I have to know my worth. After all, Evelyn wants something from me. She needs me. I don't know why or what for, but I know I wouldn't be sitting here if that weren't the case. I have value to her. I know that. And now I have to use it, just as she would if she were me. So here we go. You need to sit for a photo shoot for the cover.
No.
It's non-negotiable.
Everything is negotiable. Haven't you gotten enough? I've agreed to the excerpt.
You and I both know how valuable new images of you would be.
I said no.
Okay, here we go. I can do this. I just have to do what Evelyn would do. I have to Evelyn Hugo, Evelyn Hugo. You agree to the cover photo or I'm out. Evelyn sits forward in her chair.
Excuse me?
You want me to write your life story. I want to write your life story. But these are my terms. I'm not going to lose my job for you. And the way I keep my job is I deliver an Evelyn Hugo feature with a cover. So you either persuade me to lose my job over this, which is only possible if you tell me when this book is being sold, or you do this. Those are your options. Evelyn looks at me, and I get the impression that I am more than she bargained for. And I feel good about that. There's a smile forming that is hard to keep in.
You're having fun with this, aren't you?
She says. I'm trying to protect my interests.
Yes, but you're also good at it, and I think you're delighting in it a bit.
I finally let the smile out. I'm learning from the best.
Yes, you are,
Evelyn says. She scrunches her nose.
A cover.
A cover.
Fine, a cover. And in exchange, starting Monday, I want you here every waking moment. I want to tell you all I have to say as soon as possible. And from now on, when I don't answer a question the first time, you don't ask it again. Do we have a deal?
I get up from behind the desk, walk over to Evelyn, and put out my hand. Deal. Evelyn laughs.
Look at you, she says. You keep this up. You might just rule your own part of the world one day.
Why, thank you, I say.
Yeah,
she says, not unkindly.
Sit down at the desk, start recording, I don't have all day.
I do as I'm told, and then I look at her. All right, I say. So you're in love with Celia, you've divorced Dawn, it looks like your career is down the tubes. What's next? Evelyn takes a second to answer, and in that moment I realize that she has just agreed to the very thing she swore she would never do, a Vivant cover, just so I won't walk. Evelyn wants me for something, and she wants it bad. And now I'm finally starting to suspect that I should be scared.